Welcome to Ladies with Gumption, episode 75, License to Kill. We recap DCTV in a flash. I am your intro person, May, and I am here with
Tatiana
and Jessica.
And as always, you can reach us on Twitter at DCTV Gumption. Email us all your lovely thoughts and feelings at ladieswgumption@gmail.com. ladieswgumption.tumblr.com, where you can send us your asks. You can listen to our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and we're now on Spotify and Facebook, which we are still consistently posting week to week.
If we have to say it every week, I don't know. Like,
are we?
We're just like reminding ourselves, like, oh yes.
Exactly.
Okay.
We also have a Patreon. It's www.patreon.com/DCTVGumption, where you can send us some money if you would like to support our poor asses. We also have a new t-shirt design over on Redbubble, which you can find up on our Tumblr page, and it was posted to our Twitter account as well. It is a Ladies W Gumption design. I created and Jessica came up with the idea, and we're going to have some more stuff coming up soon. So keep checking back for that. And we have some news. So Arrow fans want to buy a billboard in Times Square, and then Stephen Amell promises to match donations up to 10K, which is amazing.
I think they basically like did that already. Like the billboard, whatever fund needed, they already had. And so they were just doing like extra stuff. And then Stephen saw it and was like, okay, up to 10 grand and I'll match it. And so, and I think they probably hit that within like the day as well. So
yeah.
So 10K fandom, is going somewhere.
Yeah. When fandom comes together for some decent things, you know, it works.
not the billboard, but like
yeah, the
charity.
The charity stuff.
Exactly. But I mean, I know, you know, you want to, it's been a show that's been around and for, you know, 7-8 years and mm-hmm. people have a lot invested in it. So
exactly.
It's their money.
Yep. And now Titans, which I also hope people are somewhat invested in, they added Issei Morales.
Serena Williams is.
Yes. Very. I saw her tweets. She's like, I'm obsessed. It's like, all right, Serena, you know? They cast Issei Morales as Deathstroke, so that's very exciting. I don't know, though, what else he's been in, but I'm just glad that they cast him, period.
Right.
And then, do you guys know what else he's been in? Any?
No, but I could find out.
Quick Google search.
He was in NYPD Blue. He was in La Bamba. NCIS Los Angeles. Oh, he was in 8 episodes of How to Get Away with Murder. He was Jorge Castillo in How to Get Away with Murder.
Oh my God. Okay. Yes.
Nice.
There we go.
All right. That sounds great. The show is also casting a biracial woman who lets, quote, nothing stand in her way, even if it means snuffing someone to get it. So no idea who that's going to be, but I'm excited.
Mm-hmm.
And then Todd Helbing is stepping down as showrunner of The Flash, and executive producer and writer Eric Wallace is being promoted to the position for season 6. So
I think that's a good thing. Change is a good thing for The Flash right now.
I agree.
I think they need some new creative blood.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it can't. Definitely. I was going to say it can't get worse, but it can't get worse as long as we've got someone coming in that's already from the world of The Flash, which Eric Wallace is.
Yeah.
You know, he's already familiar with the characters and the world. He cares about Iris and presumably the West Allen family. So, and maybe he'll hire some black women.
Eric, like that's like one thing that you, I guess like the metal of, you know, whether this is going to be a good season 6 or not is, Eric, will you hire black women on your writing staff?
Exactly.
Because that's like the one thing that The Flash has needed for like a long time and we've never gotten it. But yeah, like, you know, change was good for Arrow with Beth coming in as a showrunner. So hopefully we get lucky with Eric.
I know, lots of great changes in the Arrowverse. So hoping we'll get some more information later on. And then for Supergirl, Azzi Tesfaye I hope I pronounced that correctly. She's currently going to begin recurring as Kelly Olsen in the next episode, but she has been promoted to series regular for Supergirl's fifth season.
Woo!
So, rise.
Which is really, we haven't even seen her yet, and she's already a season regular. It's like, yay for Kara Kelly. Kellex, is that Kellex, what they're calling you, I think?
I guess, yeah.
Even though it's like Kara's like, robot is also named Kellex, but like,
yeah.
Kelly and Alex, yeah. I'm a little bit, you know, worried about what that means for James, but siblings can coexist on a show and both be alive. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, and it'll officially be, well, I mean, they have Colonel Haley, but like a person who isn't, no, Colonel Haley, is she series regular?
She is.
Oh, she is.
I believe she is a series regular.
Okay. But it'll be like the first Black woman within the like the Supergirl group. So that's exciting.
Did you see, like, apparently Ezra Miller is trying to write his own Flash script?
What? I'm sorry? It's gotten that bad.
Now Ezra Miller is trying to write his own Flash script to keep the movie alive.
That is so sad.
Yeah.
I'm screaming.
And he's writing the script with Superstar Comics author Grant Morrison. So what? He's like calling in the big guns to help him write this script to get the Flash movie written and so that he can like stay on as a Scarlet Speedster.
What happened to the other people that were writing their Flash script?
They keep imploding.
Yeah.
They keep dropping out.
This is so ridiculous.
I think everyone's allergic to the Flash movie.
I think so. The development has bubbled up from a clash. This is from the Hollywood Reporter. The development has bubbled up from a clash of creative visions. John Francis Daley and Jonathan Goldstein, who are like the latest people that are trying to write this story and have been on board since January 2018, have a lighthearted approach to the material and even hail from that sort of background with credits like Spider-Man, Homecoming, and Game Night. And as sources note, this is a general track favored by Warners. But Miller is said to want a darker take on the material. Ezra, why do we want to go
all
dark
this
with
power
Barry Allen?
To decide where they're going to go with the story. That's what
I don't know why he wants Barry to suffer, but I guess, I don't know. We don't get lighthearted Barry in the DCEU. That's interesting.
I don't know. That's really weird.
Yeah.
I think he secretly liked the concept of Flashpoint, and he probably wants to have some of that around.
We've had enough darkness in Warner Brothers, though. All right.
We have some feedback. Which I will attempt to get through. First, start with Paulina, who says that she had a lot of thoughts about Black Lightning. She says she's with Lala, to be quite honest, because at this point, killing Tobias should be the primary focus, and I'm glad at least he knows what he has to do.
He's right, and he should say it.
I have conflicting feelings towards Jeff articulating his newest set of superhero conditions, because I understand that he's a lot more concerned now than he was prior to his retirement, because now Anissa and Jennifer are both going to be out in the field, what with Jen's suit in the works. But he's approaching this as a father, and so I get why he's suddenly all about the superhero moral code. We do not kill, even if it's Tobias. But it's equally frustrating because Tobias is wreaking havoc, killing people at large, but cannot be taken into custody because there's no evidence of his crimes.
Well, that's why we have Lala.
Right. So it's less problematic than the... So if they kill him, don't they owe it to all the innocent victims and future victims whose lives they can save to do that? She thinks it's less problematic than the Flash's consent/cure storyline because you can empathize with Jeff's position, but it's still frustrating.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Over for the Flash, she feels as if it's almost easy to be disappointed with the failure is an orphan, but she thought it was a solid episode, although it's symptomatic of one of the Flash's longest running issues, which is cramming in the emotional component when this should have been shown developed over several episodes. Because the next episode is going to deal with betrayal, and then Barry and Iris wanting to spend as much time with Nora is adorable, but they should have been allowed to have that emotionally resonant and heartwarming family scenes they got in this episode throughout the rest of the season. And
right.
It feels like Barry and Iris about to catch baby fever. But having said all that, that West Island family scenes were beautiful. And while Barry convincing Dwyer to take the cure and him revealing his identity had her sighing in exasperation, Barry sold that speech to Dwyer when he appealed to him as a father. And kudos to Grant for really coming through. So yeah, overall, a solid episode. Thank you, Paulina, for all your thoughts. The rest of your email will be posted to Tumblr. Moving on to our Supergirl super fan, Shang. Hey there, lovely ladies. It's going to be really long, which I apologize, Shang. I'm not going to read everything. He wishes the elite existed independently of the Children of Liberty so that he could enjoy them as antagonists and be satisfied when they're taken down instead of being disappointed that Supergirl is actively working against them. They actually have a valid rationale and the only beings to have functioning brain cells against the problem. So when one party is calling for the murder of an entire group, stopping them is not the opposite extreme. Number two, hooray for Kara, who finally realizes she should march together with her alien buddies, I guess. That speech by Brainy was great, and I love my Kara Docs biscuit, but Kara shouldn't need to be persuaded over it by the people around her. Number three, wouldn't it be so wild if Lena knew Kara was Supergirl but thinks Kara doesn't know she's Supergirl, like how Sam didn't know she was Rain? Interesting. That is interesting. Okay, so Lena Luthor defends TED Talk. Firstly, she was extremely hesitant to go through with the trial with Adam. He had to convince her to do it. Yes, he was her only human trial. They have several exchanges of dialogue explaining that and why, so maybe having someone die on her made Lena wary of continuing human trials, hence she pushed back against Haley. Let's see. He knows he has theories on Eve, we do too, but I'm hoping she isn't evil because we don't need another person hurting Lena.
Too late, Shang. It's too late. You already put it out in the atmosphere.
I feel Lex is more involved than we think. And maybe his chess game with Lena had already started all the way back before he went to prison. Interesting. Flash feedback. He's just got to say, Tom needs to stop making Thawne sound like some ASMR. It's getting on my nerves.
That's funny.
Yeah. Thank you, Shang, for your feedback. Again, the rest of it will be posted to Tumblr. Shy sent us feedback as well. Also likes the news that Todd is leaving because believes that they need someone new to take the helm and see if they can rejuvenate the show, because then it would have like a lot of potential. She actually enjoyed the episode. She enjoyed all the West Island scenes and seeing Iris again expressing how she feels, this time about Nora leaving. It's such a refreshing difference from previous seasons. If only they would show her and Barry talking and us getting some perspective on how they feel about all that's been happening. Maybe we'll get something on screen in these last few episodes. As I sit back to taking the season as a whole so far regarding the limited amount of romance we've seen this season, I don't like it, but I've learned to live with it. This episode was a prime example of West Allen being intent on showing, or them being intent on showing West Allen as parents rather than on their romantic relationship. They've said I love you to just Nora in the back half of the season. That tells me a lot right there as to where the focus is.
Mm-hmm. That's 100. Like, that's why, I mean, we're going to talk about this in the episode, I'm sure. But I will just say that that's why I can't, I mean, there's many reasons why I can't get on board with people who are saying it's the actors or whatever, or that the writing has changed for the actors. But you can tell, because even in the lines that are being written or that are being, you know, made, like, there's no reason the actors would refuse to say romantic lines about each other. You know, they don't even say them when they're not in the same room. So clearly it's stemming from the writing priorities.
Yeah. And I think that's just people having conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
It's still a job, but anyway. But she refers to like season three in which, let me find the line. When the season was focused on like saving Iris, so that the focus was on their relationship because it was about saving her. So they wanted us to see how happy Barry was to finally get the girl of his dreams and see how deeply in love with her he was, so that when they showed her being killed, we would understand the pain and devastation Barry was going through at the thought of losing her. And she actually liked the speech that Barry gave to convince Cicada to take the cure. Appealing to him as a father made sense, and Grace being a meta angle was good. I enjoyed the sort of twist at the end with Cicada. We all knew Grace would grow up to take the reins as Cicada, but what I don't think anyone expected was for her to travel back in time. That was a huge twist for me, and she enjoyed the fight scene in the Cortex. Loved Barry and Joe talk in the lab, just brought back memories of season one, as well as showed us how much Barry has grown. And she enjoyed the Joe and Cecile team up. Not sure why it took Joe coming back for them to make the connection between Orlin and the doctor. Yes, I put that in my notes. But whatever, I'm not going to complain. She's just glad he's back. Once again, Ralph was not in this episode without an explanation as to where he's been. Once again, I didn't realize it until the episode was almost over that he wasn't in it. There's just not enough storylines to go around. I can't believe we're only at 71% with Nora's notebook decryption. Really? That plot just keeps dragging on and on.
All the technology in Star Labs and that slow-ass computer.
Sherlock was tolerable this episode. I guess his main role is to talk in circles and never get to the point. Thank you, Shai, for all your thoughts. The rest of your stuff will be posted to Tumblr. Let's see. Moving on to Mara Lee. So what to say about Flash? She liked that all the characters were actively contributing and that it felt evenly paced in terms of screen time. Overall, I went into the episode with low expectations, so I found it to be relatively decent and certainly a step up from last week. I adored the West Island family scenes, and I adored seeing Iris's point of view on Nora leaving and Nora really accounting for her mother's feelings and talking to her about all of that. I loved seeing Barry use his fatherhood to appeal to Cicada. Because while I found the whole consent business ridiculous, his speech was heart-wrenching. I didn't care about all the Cicada stuff, and I'm beyond irritated that they didn't destroy the freaking dagger before Future Grace came in and snatched it up. At this point, I'm more interested to see what happens with the Thawne reveal, because the Thawne reveal means future time travel, and I want to see Central City 2049, predominantly because I want to see Future Iris.
Yes.
Like the rest of the West Island fandom, I too miss the heart-soaring romantic moments, arguably reserved exclusively this season for 5-5 and then a little for 5-9. One episode in which Nora was alienated from her parents and another where Nora was completely absent, which definitely
is not a coincidence. Oh, noticing a pattern.
She thinks it's the lack of, or it's because of laziness, that the writers would rather write their individual scenes with Nora or have their scenes together, including Nora, because Nora drives the main plot. But she thinks it's lazy because character moments are sacrificed as the writers are not bothered to make space for West Island's romance in addition to them parenting. Before I go, I wanted to know if you ladies would agree that this season arguably has had Iris's best writing. I think season 4 might be a strong contender, but I feel as if season 5 has done a great job at showcasing her strength and her dignity, her kind heart, and her selflessness, while also exploring any personal feelings of inadequacy, both with regards to starting Central City citizen and motherhood. So do we agree with that?
Yes, I think that season 5 has been the most consistent writing for Iris, probably, in that she's always given a perspective and probably the most consistent we've seen her journalism as well, since she had a blog before she entered Central City, before she entered Picture News, so...
Yeah, I think that I agree. I would agree that it's the most consistent, at least in showing Iris's point of view and how she's feeling and dealing with that, because that's something that they just did not do in a lot in the earlier seasons. So this is definitely the most consistent in giving Iris a point of view and not leaving her with, like, Candace making a sad face on the stairs in the corner.
Yeah, exactly. She gets to, like, talk about everything, and I think that's really important. And I agree, it's been very consistent, because we've seen that since, like, the very first episode of the season. All right, we have one last piece of feedback from our lovely friend, Swara, who sent us a Twitter DM.
Oh.
Yes. Good evening, ladies. I have some thoughts about this week's Supergirl. As Alex and Brainy can say, I am confounded by this episode as well as infuriated. I think we all thought this episode would be finally be a cathartic release of the alien victims being able to express their sincere feeling and experiences. Instead, we got a mess of both sides-ism, with the characters hitting us over the head with the notion that all sides have committed bad. No, that is not how this works. Institutional racism is not the fault of the oppressed. I think we can all agree that Supergirl has completely failed to tell this allegorical story well, in my opinion, without even a shred of genuine nuance or empathy for what marginalized people actually go through. I'm very disappointed and hope that hope that CW tackles a political storyline again, that they don't just rely on social media from both sides to tell them what's what and actually do their bloody research.
Preach.
Yes. So these are real issues that deserve attentive care, and the writing has been lazy at best and terribly offensive at worst. Also, haven't we already settled the question of Kara's side on this issue? Why are the writers continuing to both sides her? Again, incredibly infuriating. Looking forward to our thoughts. Thank you, Suara. We are also constantly infuriated with the show. And we will discuss that in our likes and dislikes. So, moving into our actual format, all the shows are on this week again, and we have Supergirl and Arrow on side A, and Flash, Black Lightning, and Doom Patrol on side B, likes, dislikes, and Ladies with Gumption nominee and winner of the week, and Jess will take over as your host.
All right, cool kids. So we're starting on side A, Supergirl and Arrow, El Mayara, and Protocols. First up, we have Supergirl. A recap of what this episode was about. Supergirl takes a stand between Ben Lockwood's new push to stir up the anti-alien movement and the elite's desire to target Lockwood and his minions. Supergirl is concerned about the safety of the American people, who are also primarily human and primarily white.
Yeah.
But anyway, both human and alien, according to this thing, this recap, whatever. When Lockwood organizes a rally, the aliens decide to peacefully protest. Brainiac and John join the alien march that Brainy founded as American Alien, while Supergirl and Dreamer patrol to keep everyone safe. Meanwhile, James picks up his camera again to cover the march for Catco, and Haley assigns Alex a job that clashes with her beliefs, aka protecting a white supremacist. When the elite and Ben Lockwood stir up trouble at the rally, Supergirl is forced to take a stand. Jonathan Bennett guest stars as Aaron Samuels because, you know, why else this would he there?
This poor man will never move past that role.
Andy Armiganian directed this episode, written by Rob Wright and Jess Cardos. What did we like about this episode?
Who would like to go first?
You can share your lovely thoughts first.
Oh, that is so sweet. Okay. I will say that I enjoyed the Reservoir Dogs style beginning when they played Stuck in the Middle with You for the Elite. Nice reintroduction to them. Made them look super cool. I approve. Also loved that excellent Friday Night Lights reference. Clear eyes, full tums, can't lose. when it came to, you know, fighting, I forget her name constantly. Whatever. Man-eater lady. Menagerie. Thank you. I always want to call her just man-eater.
Man-eater lady.
But anyway. Okay, so Menagerie. I enjoyed, like, Nia's, like, overexcitability, right? Like, her, like, not knowing what level to be at when it comes to being a hero. How much threat she should put into her power poses. and that was funny mostly because I just can't ever imagine her actually following through with extreme violence. So, like, while normally I would be like, Kara's like, oh no, you have to be like this. You know, I was like, I would have like a serious thing to say about that, but I don't because I don't think that Nia would ever do anything. So it just all comes across as humorous. Like, don't scare them too much, Nia. Just anyway, so whatever. It was cute. Okay, moving on. I also, you know, like that the show took the time to sort of establish how important the Alien Amnesty Act is just in terms of everyone's reactions to it, right? And how everyone was feeling about the idea that it could be repealed. I also like that we got to see different people play different kinds of roles doing their part to come together for the counter protest. Obviously, the most importantly, or not most importantly, but like the one that I liked the most was Brainy actually being American Alien. Like actually, like that was a fun twist. And also we get to see just how important it is to Brainy. And how he's sort of channeled his own sense of vulnerability or his own like loss of his Legion ring, which I feel like has to come into play at some point, but whatever. How he's channeled that into wanting to do something constructive, productive for the community, right? And the idea that you're stronger together, whatever. I thought that was like best exemplified by him in this episode. I also liked that other people, you know, got to take a stand, although I disliked how long it took some of them to do it. But but I liked, you know, Alex getting testy with what's his face, Ben. I'm glad Nia and Kara joined Brainy. And I liked how important James's journalism was to the protest and then how it became a crucial turning point in stopping the repeal of the Alien Amnesty Act. There we go. I also liked seeing Super Friends in action once again. And it was, you know, like seeing humans helping aliens and vice versa had the intended effect in universe, right? Like the narrative of James's photo actually affecting the outcome of Lockwood's campaign to repeal the act, I thought was a good show for the importance of the press, right? Because in real life, we do have those kind of moments where like a photo or like an article or whatever can change the narrative. So that I like. Whew. I feel like we're getting a slow climb back to Kaylee being decent, or not back to, just to Haley being decent. So I'm all for that. And I hope that that continues. And on the sort of opposite, but not really vein, I like the way that John's struggle with violence is playing and how he sort of like sees himself and Manchester as diametrically opposed, but Manchester sees them more as mirror images. So we get to see like the ideological battle between them. And right now it seems like Manchester is winning. David Harewood is playing that well. And they're sort of like sprinkling it through every episode in a successful way.
I do feel like John and Manchester is like the one dynamic of this whole situation that Supergirl writers are actually either they're getting it right or just it's just David's acting that's making it right. I just something I don't know, but I feel like it's the most like in-depth like character development wise that they've been consistent on throughout the whole season.
Yeah, and I think that they're giving it a little bit more nuance than their actual main storyline too, because they're failing elsewhere. Anyway, what I did like was Brainy, you know, ending up being behind the peaceful protest idea and that he used hashtag American Alien as his name. It was really clever. And I thought that he gave really convincing arguments and was very much the hope and the voice of reason when it came to believing Kara should take a stand as an alien and citizen of Earth and not as Supergirl, the superhero. It actually said a lot about how Brainy has become a little bit of the heart of the show in a lot of ways. And for the first time since the season started, I could see how the Brainy-Kara ship could rise. I noticed how the camera lingered on the moment Kara took Brainy's hand. I know maybe it wasn't meant to be that big of a deal, but I took it as a big of a deal.
Like, I will take it.
Yes. And I also love the way in which Nia kept trying to be really harsh with her words as a superhero and that Kara kept having to tell her to tone it down. And Menagerie being annoying about her like choice of shoes I thought was really hilarious. And then John's subplot with Manchester made him come off a bit like a hot and bothered ex-lover the way he let Manchester get under his skin.
Yes!
Yeah, there's a weird little love triangle going on there between John Hatt and Manchester.
Yes. And I do agree. His arc is really consistent this season and really strong. And like he's battling his own instinctual anger and the more peaceful life he promised to live and to live to honor his father. He's putting the blame on Manchester and it's making him act out because Manchester is too close to the person he'd been after his wife and kids died. And I like that this has been one of the more well-developed aspects of the season. And then Alex having to deal with being the head of Lockwood's security detail and then shutting him up and getting him off the stage after saying that he's actually the threat was a long overdue moment. And I'm annoyed that it took that long. And then finally, I really liked that James went back to being a photographer, however briefly that moment lasted. Like, his work was praised, he was making a difference while being out in the field, and he was making a difference along with everyone else, which was important. So that's why I hated what happened after, but that's for later.
Yeah. That's definitely like the uglier side of the episodes. We'll say that for a little bit afterwards. But for me, like, I think I really enjoyed like Nia's overexcitement about being a superhero. It's just like really infectious and adorable. And like, considering it's coming from someone that didn't really want to be a superhero at first, and now mm-hmm. she's like really like overly excited. It's kind of like she and Jennifer from Black Lightning are kind of in the same situation in that neither one of them really wanted powers. But now that they have powers and they've gotten kind of used to it, they're really like excited about like what's next. And they're actually like, Nia's doing all this crazy stuff with like her powers that, you know, how long were they training in the fortress? Because she's just like really like grown over such a period of time of the different things that she can do with her actual dream powers. As opposed to just like falling asleep and dreaming stuff, she can actually like use that and manipulate it in a really cool way. So like, just her excitement for being a superhero was really nice to see. You know, sleeping in the suit and just ready at all times. Like, I loved her trying to find the right tone with her superhero lines, like yield or die. Like, Kara's like, take it down, not. She's like, okay, yield or else. I thought that was like hilarious. So just like Nia's like excitement in general was infectious. I too like the opening scene with like the elite. They're like leaving the bar, like they're the Beatles or some like rock stars or something like that. And they, you know, have like a plan. And then that, you know, the super friends start taking away one member at a time of their team. And you get this like, the hat in Manchester. Specifically, I really like their relationship and their kind of bromance and the kind of internal struggle within the elite of, you know, what is this fight really for? Is it for revenge or is it for a revolution? So you kind of get like, you know, within the elite, they have their own kind of, you know, the moral right of what they're doing versus just revenge for revenge's sake. And so I think, again, like it kind of makes you, you know, with the elite being the only people that are the only group that are actively going against Children of Liberty, it kind of has like a different effect on me than probably what the writers want us to feel about the elite, about them being the bad guys or whatever. But I do like that with Hat and Manchester, that they don't stay mad at each other for long and that they all kind of like have each other's backs. And the fact that they're so like resourceful and how like they basically broke into Supergirl's fortress, like the fortress, the Solitude. Like, who does that? Like, what, you know, how, like, what kind of villain do you have to be able to like actually break into Supergirl's home? So it's just kind of saying like something like, you know, how good the elite are as like a team together. And then again, like you guys are saying with James, with John in Manchester, and how that has just been like consistently developing over the course of the season, with him seeing Manchester as being like the mirror image of the Manhunter that he used to be. And you kind of see, John slowly losing his, tug of war of, you know, the peaceful life that his father practice versus that easy rise to anger Manhunter side. And I especially like the fight when the fight broke out and he was going after Manchester and he's basically lost control at this point and wanting to get in, you know, stop Manchester himself. And Manchester actually uses that rage against John by taking like a Children of Liberty person and like projecting his image and antagonizing John to hit him and all this kind of stuff. And then later John realizes that what, you know, he kind of sees like the monster that, you know, he's become a little bit, which, I mean, it's the Children of Liberty, but I don't really care about that person, but for John and his mental state of this is how far Manchester gets him to go. I thought it was really cool. What else did I like? Oh, I also like, you know, Alex, you know, shutting down Ben Lockwood and getting him out for being the threat. And then afterwards, when she has the conversation with Kara about being inspired by Supergirl to act and to stand up, I thought was a really nice moment, especially because Alex doesn't know her sister is Supergirl. So to go from, mm-hmm. you know, having her memories wiped and being like a little bit professional, call me Director Danvers, Supergirl, to slowly working with Supergirl and the Super Friends and going against like her job to, you know, actually taking a stand and being a girl. I think that's like a really nice little transition. It's made like the Alex doesn't know storyline feel more three-dimensional. It has like a lot of depth to it. So I agree.
It's a very nice art.
Yeah. That's enough about what we like. So what we maybe did not like about this episode.
All right. This is kind of silly, but I didn't like that Menagerie was just like out to like eat whoever. I was like, at the very least, like track down some Children of Liberty person and eat them. So and I was like, okay, I guess she can go to jail. Can't have her eating randos. So I didn't like that. Although she is very funny. Speaking of, this is silly, but like they were picking off the, you know, the elite one by one, but like you can tell who doesn't matter and who does. Cause like the whole episode was Hat and Magister. And I forgot the Moray even existed aside from the fact that they found his claw and then she got taken in. So I was like, all right. Okay. But anyway, I still didn't get how the Hat found the key. Like, it does Supergirl really just leave the key buried in the snow and just assume that no one else is strong enough to pick it up?
Because that's really like 5,000 kilos.
Yeah, but like
the equivalent of leaving your key underneath like the welcome mat.
Exactly. Like, what are you doing? Especially because like it's not like Zod doesn't exist. You know, like there are other supervillains that are just as strong as you. And this is very stupid. Whatever. So I was just like, okay, that was dumb, Kara. You deserved that. So anyway, the Quentin and Aaron Samuels guy, like this is where, you know, we get back into Supergirl, maybe not knowing exactly what to do, ideologically speaking. He was seemed so unnecessary this whole episode. Like, I don't know what the purpose of him was, aside from making Kara look more wishy-washy and then giving us just like, oh, the power of her positivity can turn this random xenophobe into a heartwarming rescuer of aliens. You know, I was like, why? Why couldn't Brainy's speech have convinced Kara on its own to go stand with him? I don't know. I felt like that downplayed what Brainy had to say, right? The fact that both Kara and Nia were like, no. And then later they're like, yes, actually, other things. They just come. Like, why? I think Swara already said this, but like, Kara should already know. You know, she's just like them. Like, we're all the same, right? She doesn't need to join the march just to prove to Aaron Samuels that she is like them. It's something that she already knows. Like, I feel like I would equate this to Barry pulling off his mask in order to connect with a villain. Like, I get where you're coming from in the narrative, but we've done this enough times that it doesn't mean anything to us as viewers. And it's something that they should already know better. So that did not work for me. Okay. Also, the crowd at the protest, it's so easily influenced. They're just like mindless little zombies. I know they're just extras and that's what they do. They don't want to waste time telling them to do different things, but it really bothers me. It's just like that Arrow prison riot where I'm like, okay, so someone was like, let's be peaceful. And everyone was like, yes, peace. And the minister comes and is like, let's be violent. Yes, violence. And then someone else comes like, let's help each other. Yes, help each other. Whatever. It's just not realistic. I don't like it. Also don't like, cause I loved that James was taking the photos. And like I said, I loved what impact that had. I did not love Mad World playing in like slow motion over the protest scenes. I was like, this is the cheesiest thing I've ever seen in my life. It was like the opposite of Stuck in the Middle with You playing at the beginning of the episode. I was like, this was a bad musical choice. Also, all I can think of is Donnie Darko when you do that. So,
and I guess like with that, like Mad World and everything is like falling apart. But then like James is also taking photos of things like coming together. So it's just like disconnects.
Yep.
You know, where are you trying to go for? Are you trying to go for chaos and the end of the world? Are you trying to go for like Kumbaya and, you know, there is hope? Like,
right. Yeah. It was just, everything is wrong with that. All right.
All I could think about was that scene in Riverdale when.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, Mad World. I'm like, oh my God. Oh. Why is it on Supergirl?
Finally, I really don't like James getting shot. I mean, for a multitude of reasons. Like, obviously, I don't want James to die. I don't like the imagery of him being shot. But also, we already saw from the reaction of fandom, there was like a tweet about it or whatever, and like all the fandom reaction was so ugly. And I feel like it's just playing into that. Like, why would you do that? Even if he survives, I really don't like that it happened at all. And also, this is like the first time that he actually got to be effective with his journalism. Like, we just started with him actually being a good journalist. So let's not shoot him the first time he does anything.
Yeah, I think the fandom reaction was because Supercore fans want Supercore, even though...
Yeah, but that doesn't mean, like
Guardian is already dead. Like, Guardian, they had broken up the episode before, so,
it's
like...
It's just so ugly. Like, just the fact that, like, how badly are you reading this show, or how badly is this show conveying anything to you that you see James being shot because he actually did something to help the aliens on a public scale as a good thing? Like, obviously, the show's not sending the right message. The show's not doing its job. You're not watching it right. So, whatever.
Very, very true. Anyway, yeah, Ben Lockwood getting a public platform, inciting fear, division, and hatred, and then having to be protected, even though he's a murderer, was really frustrating. Like, the aliens got to protest, but he had a public platform, even though he's committed terrible acts. He's killed people. He's, you know, rallied against aliens and vocally spoken out to have them killed. And I feel like I repeat this weekly at this point, but the show continues with the bullshit that people like Ben Lockwood deserve to be heard, but aliens aren't receiving the same podium as he is, and the elite are labeled the bad guys. So I can't believe I'm saying The Flash did it better this week, even though it was, like, really minor. But Barry was arguing with Cicada that just because Grace is a meta, does that mean she deserves to die? And the answer is no. Like, it should be the aliens and their right to live. And they should be getting this spotlight. And I also didn't buy for 1 second that Manchester was really dead. So the 2 minutes spent on that fell flat. And Aaron Samuels, I completely agree. He was wasted. First of all, he was saved by Supergirl the first time, but he was... at the rally as a DEO agent ready to scream about how much he hated aliens, but not Supergirl because she's a superhero. So that argument
That's so stupid. That like whole argument is so stupid.
Yeah, it's completely ridiculous. And then fits in with the notion that only liking one alien is okay, but the other aliens shouldn't have the right to live.
And have everyone an alien is so friend. Easily...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, yeah. It's like the new, I have a black friend. I can't be racist.
And then everyone is so easily swayed. So 1 second, they're peacefully protesting, like Tati said. And the next second, everyone is fighting each other. And I agree, finding the key and having Kara leave the key outside was weird. First of all, it's like the first, it's the Fortress of Solitude. She should have a Supergirl retina scan or something. Otherwise, why not just have Brainy and Nia given them the key last episode instead of taking them there herself? And
I guess because he can't lift it. It's 5,000 kilos.
I guess not, but it's just like, it's this big gold key, you know, and it's just sitting there.
Gaudy.
And then Hat getting there is still a mystery to me, unless I missed something.
Mixie, Mr. Mix, whatever, pronounce, is his friend.
Yeah, and I agree with Tati. I forgot to write this down, but when she was talking about how Brainy trying to convince Kara wasn't enough, and that was a dislike, and I dislike that too, especially since Nia was like, I'm doing whatever Supergirl's doing. It's like, I thought that Nia would want to stand and do this for aliens, considering that she comes from a place where generally she was like treated well and stuff like that, but other people aren't. And she has been writing about Lockwood. So I thought,
yeah, and we didn't even see what changed her mind. Right.
Exactly.
It's just, I guess Supergirl's here. So I too am here.
Exactly. And then finally, I also didn't like James being shot after everything. I don't know who did it, but it just made it seem like one of those episodes where a character really does something great, is noticed by the public, has stuff going for them, and then bam, all that's taken away, like Laurel's death episode in season 4 of Arrow. Like, that's what it felt like to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess for me, like, I don't... I can give Nia a little bit of slack because I think that she was, I'm just going to put it up, chalk it up to her being like overly excited about everything superhero and being like, you know, on patrol and excited about doing that. And that's like making a difference or whatever. But I will get to the brainy Kara of it all. But first, like minor dislike, like, I don't know if this was just like a directing error or like a writing mistake or they just don't care, but like when Kara goes and does her sweep around the world looking for Manchester and the rest of the elite and they come back to John's office or whatever and she's in civilian clothes, like she's been flying around as Kara Danvers, and then she's coming in and she's talking about how she cannot find Manchester and there's Menagerie over there in the corner watching Fashion Week. And within earshot of everyone talking about like Supergirl and super shit, Menagerie's just over there, like, and she can see Kara, even like wearing her glasses. This isn't Supergirl. This is a girl that looks like Supergirl wearing glasses. Nothing is mentioned about that at all. And then like later, I guess, and I think someone else mentioned this too, but when Kara actually does join the Marsh, she's like, I'm here as Kara Zor-El. I'm like, you just said your name. You just said Kara. So we know Supergirl's name is Kara now.
You're right.
So I don't know. Yeah. That was like a miss for me. And she said it in front of like a bunch of different people. I don't know. Anyways, on to what like I really, really have an issue with is like the whole state function terrorism of, you know, President Baker making like this white supremacist in charge of alien affairs. And then like been using that platform, they gave him a platform and he's using this platform to hold rallies that have, you know, basically are just to incite hate speech and riots and all of this kind of stuff. And it's like giving him a license to just spread this and say that it's backed by the government, which I just... It's really difficult and disheartening to, you know, for him to have so much platform to just spread hate. And I also didn't like the whole all sides of it, you know, the whole episode. And that Kara like flat out says, oh man, the elite are just as bad as the Children of Liberty, as if they're like two children, like she's disappointed in, like, oh, man, you know, I thought that was, it makes Kara seem, you know, on the fence, really, like y'all are saying, like really wishy-washy. Like John has like the emotional connection to Manchester, and that development that's been clearly developed. So Kara doesn't have any real connection to the villain to work off of because she's not as connected to Manchester as John is. And she's also not really connected or invested to defeating Ben Lockwood. So like, where is she in this kind of morality spectrum within the show? Like she's not really centered. And then you also have the fact that Brainy in this episode, which I forgot, you know, in my likes, he's an American alien. He has like the alien side of the hope and justice that should be Kara's as like the protagonist of her show. Like she should be American alien. But Brainy is really being like the hero that I feel like I need Kara to be in this situation with, you know, aliens' lives at stake. And she is like an alien as well. And she's been like, you know, in previous seasons, I feel like they hit more of that with, you know, her standing up for alien rights and protections. So it just kind of hits a little weak this season that she is kind of on the all sides, both sides of the fence, doesn't really want to make a stand. And with the elite, you know, they're counter terrorists, you know, like they're countering terrorism. Like the Children of Liberty are also terrorists. And so, and I feel like maybe if Kara and her, like the DEO, super friends, whatever, had taken a stronger stance against the Children of Liberty from the beginning of the season, the extreme actions by the elite would actually look extreme. You know, and like, for example, if, you know, Kara and the elite were actually more on the same page in the beginning, like her and Manchester were more on the same page, then I don't know, like him, his, the, okay, so the confrontation between Hat and Manchester in this episode, I think would have been, could have been like a Kara Manchester kind of plot line. That could have been like where their divergence split. And she doesn't really have that either. So, you know, it kind of comes off as there's these kind of respectability politics thing with Kara. Like, I don't, you know, like the, where's, what show is it? I think it was like Dr. Phil or whatever with the black girl that thought she was white. She's like, I'll never be one of those Negroes. Like,
oh, that's, yeah.
That's kind of what it feels like. You know, like Kara is a good alien. And even like Aaron Samuel said, like, you're not one of those aliens. You're a good alien. You're a superhero. And mm-hmm. somehow that makes her, you know, different. Like, that's the only thing that makes her different. Like, I don't like all aliens, but I like you, Supergirl. And I kind of low-key think Kara didn't want to go to Brainy's March for the same reason. Like, she is separate from other aliens, even though it was Brainy who organized it. And I feel like the fact that she was surprised that it was Brainy also makes me feel like she was like, you know, myself and Brainy and the select aliens that I know are the good and separate category from everybody else. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Kara being the exception, it's basically the only reason why Aaron Samuels was getting money to appear in this episode, because otherwise he just had no purpose. And I feel like if this was the point, the whole point or driving theme this episode was for Kara to learn that, you know, check her kind of privilege, superhero privilege, if you want to call it, then I feel like they should have leaned into that more heavily. But I know that, you know, that's kind of like a byproduct, because I know what they were really meaning to push was a whole, like, you know, good people on both sides, kumbaya bullshit of James getting pictures of humans and aliens suddenly starting to help each other, which, you know, great for James in that it was a good moment for journalism. But I also kind of just felt like it's, you know, it's like what you're saying with like the extras, 1 minute, everybody fight. Now everybody help each other. And it's just kind of, there's no, you know, it just seems very one-sided or the other, like very quick the way that it turns just for the sake of the plot. And like somehow this is all going to lead to like world peace. And I feel like that's what the season is coming up to. And it's just really not realistic. And also, like, this is another kind of, it's less minor than Menagerie and Kara like exposing her identity, but why are all the aliens in this march humanoid? Like, all, like, during that fight when the riot broke out, I couldn't really tell who was human and who was alien, because they all looked human, like all right. The aliens were humanoid, and there's only, you can only tell because when they have like claws coming out of their arms or something stupid like that. And like, it's all well and good for James to get like a picture of like a human and a human looking alien. And then somehow like people can, oh, he looks kind of like me kind of thing, but there's no right. like, moray looking aliens. There's no like diversity in like the aliens. Like those are the ones that, you know, like if you compare it to being like a black person, in America or any other like minority, like I can't change the color of my skin to make you feel more comfortable. Aliens that don't look humanoid can't really change unless they have like Lena's like tech. They can't really change.
Yeah, I was
going
to say, unfortunately, they have that tech that yeah. they just introduced so that they don't have to show us.
So they don't have to show us
humanoid.
That. Yeah.
Yeah.
But actually, like, makes it interesting that Brainy went as his human self too.
True.
Now that you bring that up. Yeah.
Yeah. That's why I would just assume that everyone is wearing, you know, their little, whatever you call that, mask. But it is like a way of Supergirl's cutting corners with a budget, but it also makes it seem like you can only go so far with acceptance.
Right.
Which is not what they are intending, but that is what they are presenting.
Again, like the byproducts of, you know, not really having a clear vision, I guess.
Yeah. Writers need to take a side.
Or not even believing, you know, not even really fully believing, like, what you are trying to say is, like, the good thing. Mm-hmm. Anywho. Predictions.
Eve Tessmacher is evil and is working with Lex, and she became even more suspicious this episode because she couldn't see good guys. Who says that?
I definitely agree that, like, Lex is already behind things that are in motion that we do not know about yet, and we will find out next episode. Yes.
Yes.
I'm going to go ahead and say James is not dead yet. He is not dead yet. He's not yet dead. Okay.
I think he could go into a coma, but yeah, he's not dead.
And I'm going to go even further and say that Eve is the one that shot James.
Omo!
Yes. Because I think I'm just, Shane, you put it out in the universe, so I'm picking it up and I'm running with it. the fact that he called her in and had that conversation about the black budget with her, and she kind of, you know, was like, she did like panic a little bit, and claimed that she was going to go tell Lena about it. And like May said, like she said, like, we're one of the good guys lines. But I think Lena doesn't even know about that black budget, because I think it's Lex's black budget that he had, like, installed within L Corp before he went to prison. And maybe, like, and Eve, like, I don't really like Eve. I've never really liked her since she arrived in the Supergirl universe. But if she is working for Lex, and she has been, and it's just, like, one big long con, I might actually like her. They're like the longest con payoff.
That would be crazy. That would be crazy.
She's been around since like season one, right?
Season two.
And like background, yeah.
Yeah.
But
so she joins Catco.
Yeah.
When James gets there, and like we know like James and Kal-El are connected. And so like she gets a job at Catco, and then like, and it would also explain how the heck she is like undercover. Like she's this ditzy assistant by day and undercover bio-nuclear physicist or whatever by night.
Yeah,
and it's suddenly like the only person that can be like Lena's assistant. Like it would make so much more sense if it was because she was secretly like before she was like working with Lex, and now she's been just mm-hmm. one long con to get Lex out of prison through this like channeling money through like the black budget.
I'm here for it.
I buy it.
Next up on Arrow, Training Day. Team Arrow attempts to work with the SCPD. Attempts is a word that I use lightly because they tried for like a second, and that was about as long as that attempt lasted. But much to Oliver's frustration, things don't go as planned. Meanwhile, Dinah gets some life-changing news. Rubinata directed this episode, written by Emilio Ortega Aldrich and Rebecca Rosenberg. What did we like about this episode?
I'll start off by saying that Diaz's death was confirmed, so he won't just be popping up like a damn daisy. It makes me very excited, so I like that. And I really love Dinah's arc this episode, and I think Juliana Harkavy acted her ass off and really delivered the emotions. Like, she had a heavy burden on her shoulders because the mayor was watching her like a hawk, and I think she took that pressure in and made the best out of the situation, especially when she probably felt terrible talking to her friends the way that she did. But she had every right to, considering that they weren't listening. And I really like that she got to express her emotions after what happened to her, and then finding out that she could no longer use her canary cry. And then Renee being really supportive was really important to see, because I love their friendship, and I think that him being there for her and realizing that something was going on with her, it was really great. And then that he reminded her that Zoe looked up to her not because of her canary cry, but because she always did what was best for the city and stood as a symbol of good. It's just a nice reminder for us all that suit or no suit, people can be heroes. And then I'm also really glad that Laurel got her own subplot as well. She really held her own as DA when she went to see Bronze Tiger, and I like that she did it on her own. She had some nice exchanges, and I have to say I was a bit surprised Emiko turned out to be the killer. And I also like the very beginning where Team Arrow was at the station wearing the shirts, arguing over their suits and looking bored and annoyed. They looked like they were in the movie Police Academy, and it was probably like the best part of them, like, being part of the police, you know, all of them together. And then it makes sense now that Connor being the assumption is he's Bronze Tiger's son based on what we were given, and why, and that's why Diggle adopted him, though it doesn't explain where JJ is, and that's not like alike, but I just had to put that in there. And I have to say, I did enjoy Mia and William's team up in the future, and I find it fascinating that Mia is like her dad, though she didn't grow up with him, and then William is like Felicity, even though, if we're being honest, he barely grew up with her too.
As for myself, I love the title, Training Day, A-plus title. Great, great choice. And also a great showcase for Dinah and Juliana, as you said. I really liked her journey, discovering that being a hero, it is about what she does. It's not about the powers that she has, necessarily. And I felt really bad for her throughout the episode, being pulled in two separate directions, trying to keep her cool throughout, being professional when no one else would, but also trying to be fair to her friends. And she was right about following proper procedure, which I will get into in my dislikes. I did like that we got a nice peek at the Renee and Dinah friendship again. That I liked that he was the one that understood that she was going through something deeper that had to do with her attack. And every time they interact, I, you know, want to cry because I'm thinking about the future. But it's like a good thing because I like how they're showing where they are now. And it's one thing where I'm like, I'm really excited and scared to see how they end up where they are later. And then hopefully how that gets resolved. So that's one that I do like a lot. I also enjoyed, like you said, May, the actual like Training Day sequence at the start with Team Arrow snarking at the cops and just being over their joint project before it had even begun. I also liked Oliver trying to plaster a smile on his face while he's like growling inside. Reminds me of how he was in the crossover, especially in the flash part of the crossover. And that's smiling like my favorite kind of Oliver. So, also, I liked that Diggle being the voice of reason when Elicity were first going off the walls. I thought he gave in like a little bit too easily, but I did like his reaction to the pregnancy. Yeah. I thought that was very cute. Showed, you know, gave us some of that little friendship vibe from the early seasons. I also did like the final scene where they were like coming in with baby names. Like, I'm like, Mia being short for Moira, like, I don't know how you got that, but I love
letters.
Exactly. But I love that idea. I love that you thought that. I don't know how you got there, but that was great. anyway, I was glad that Felicity eventually found a legal way to do a fast search. Who knew it was possible? And that the team was actually compromising, even though, again, this is my dislikes. The compromise was a little bit like, forget it, Jack, it's Chinatown. Because, like, you're never going to find a realistic and believable team up between law enforcement and vigilantes. It's literally, not how it works, but that's fine. In the context of this show, it was nice that both sides were able to, like, see each other's points of views and came to some conclusion. I loved Laurel's story. I loved how she and Bronze Tiger interacted. I gave you his name elsewhere, and I've now forgotten it. Ben Turner.
Yes. Yeah.
Ben Turner. I love how she and Ben interacted. It's nice to see him be really soft with Connor. I also liked how quickly she did come through. You know, like, she was able to get Connor, to bring him to see his dad, and how, you know, he was a man of his word. And he was like, all right, let me help you with this information now. He didn't even spend time with his son before he gave her the information. He was like, you go sit over there while I tell you everything. I also, like, I really liked her confronting Emiko. I thought it was kind of bittersweet because, like, she was all ready to expose Emiko. She's, like, being the DA, kicking ass. And then Emiko kind of, like, reminds her of who she, quote unquote, really is, right? And is like, right. Yeah, well, no one's going to believe Black Siren. And I was like, oh, like, she really was shocked by that, by Emiko pulling that card. And I was like, the team is still going to believe you. Like, that's stupid. But in general, you know, like, if the world at large found out who she was, if there was a way to prove
it. Everyone won't believe her. Like, I'll go ahead and put that prediction out now.
Felicity could believe her. But I mean, if she has proof of it, you know, either way, the real concern would be if people found out, you know, because team already knows she's Black Siren. But
right.
That would bring her whole world crumbling down, you know?
Yeah.
So I like that.
So hard to build. Exactly. My little canary child.
I liked William and Mia's banter. I like, as May pointed out already, how they are each like the other parent. It's a nice little role reversal. And then the rest is in the dislikes.
We didn't get Tasha's email, so I assume she didn't like this episode.
It was about Dinah, so it probably wasn't one of her favorites. But I like Dinah, and I also like Laurel. And both Mike and Leary ladies had strong character-driven storylines in this episode. Even though they have not been able to speak to each other in months.
They're going through withdrawals.
I am, for sure. But but it was nice that... And this one, like, you know how we were talking about last week with The Flash, it really makes sense. Like, Iris had a very good subplot, but it was not connected to the main plot. Mm-hmm. And Laurel's kind of in that situation in this episode where she's not really connected to the rest of the main cast, but she still has a really decent arc. And I kind of feel like this one in Arrow works a little bit better than in The Flash in the sense that Laurel's plot still connected like threads from the main overall present arc of Dante and, you know, Emiko, and Dante being the big bad. And it also subtly tied together the future plot by revealing the major plot point of Connor being Ben's son. I really enjoyed Ben's scenes with Laurel and how much, because it just shows kind of like how much Laurel has grown as a DA in such a short period of time. And she's good at her job. Like, homegirl is really good at her does because she's able to get his son to him, you know, like that. And I do think that she's sincere about this being her new lease on life, which, you know, we consider what Tati mentioned about the ending scene between her and Emiko, and Emiko throwing the Black Siren thing in their face and the kind of shock on Laurel to think about, you know, she has this good life now. She's worked hard. She's done it the right way this time. And then she doesn't want to lose that. And, you know, going back to the previous episode with her and Felicity and her not wanting to pull the trigger on Diaz again, it's she has roots here. And so that makes it even scarier, the fact that her past could wind up taking this away from her. So I liked that whole story. And then the fact that Ben's son name is Connor, and he greeted by calling him my little hawk. So obviously Connor Hawk, we know that we know in the future that Diggle adopted, is actually Ben's son. And I have theories on why Diggle adopted him rather than Oliver, since Oliver was the one that made promise to Ben to make it right. But that, you know, prediction. So I'll save that for later. But back to the main plot, I thought that Dinah was really the star of that plot. It's the first time we see her back on the job, I think, after her attack. And I like from her perspective how the episode really centered her as being caught on two sides, the vigilante side and the legal side of the SCPD, and not knowing how to balance the two. It's like when you have two best friends that don't like each other and they always want you to pick sides. So she's in the middle. And we already know she's already on thin ice with her SCPD BFFs because Pollard doesn't want her, you know, is really strict about how much leeway she's willing to give the vigilante task force on this. And then her vigilante BFFs certainly weren't really making it easy or doing a good job of playing nice. They tried, they put in their A+ effort, but it just wasn't really working. And so you have Dinah caught in the middle. And while I don't get why any of her vigilante friends, particularly Renee, since they're actually friends, ever really stopped to consider her point of view as the police chief, I was relieved when Renee straight up asked her what's wrong, because it allowed her a moment to actually express how she was feeling after she was attacked and lost her canary cry. The opening montage with the training day, I really enjoyed that. I agree, it kind of has police academy vibes, and Team Arrow is just being overachievers and just being way above the SCPD standard level of, you know, excellence. It was a really funny sequence. And that's where the fun stopped for me. So the rest of that will go into dislikes. In the future plot, I did think the oil water dynamic between Mia and William trying to figure each other out was really cute. I'm amused by Mia's complete lack of knowledge about cassette tapes and answering machines. Those Gen Xers don't know about cassette tapes or CD-ROMs or any of that stuff. And then the ending scene, And the ending scene only of Elicity talking in bed about baby names was sweet. Not that, just that scene. But I think I agreed, like, the OTA scene with them telling Diggle about the pregnancy was also cute. But there's a lot of stuff that they were doing that's just not on board with. So that is, I think, a good segue into what we did not like about this episode. Who wants to start?
I'll add that I like those scenes too. But moving into what I didn't like... I didn't like that Dinah had to face the consequences of everyone's actions throughout the episode, and I don't think it was fair for her to take on that responsibility. She told the team several times that this is what they had to do in order to gain the trust of the mayor, and then still Felicity and Oliver went behind her back and did what they wanted to do anyway. They didn't even give it a real shot before becoming impatient and going against the rules. And it's even more frustrating because Oliver has been working under Dinah and SCPD for a while now, so there's no reason for him to suddenly want to speed things up. He should know the drill right after all of this. He should know the drill after all this time. What started as something funny turned into Felicity and Oliver acting like inconsiderate jerks. And in this case, like, we get it. Felicity is the best hacker and regular computers are slow. Woe is she. So that part was just really annoying. Like, it didn't have to... She could have been a better friend, and Oliver could have been a better friend to Dinah, knowing how hard it was for her too. And there was no reason for Dinah to apologize to Oliver either, especially after he disobeyed and went behind her back instead of respecting her as captain. Even if she felt she was harsh because of the personal stuff she was going through, he and Felicity were in the wrong for me personally. And I also thought it was too unrealistic for Oliver and Felicity to think they could clean up the city in a couple of months in time for Felicity to announce her pregnancy. Oliver has been at it for 7 years, and they somehow think Star City has and will improve in such a short amount of time. Like, have rational goals here. I know it's meant to be so that we feel worse about what actually happens in the future, but I think if they truly wanted to keep their families safe, they would start to think and act a bit more rationally and logically. And then, speaking of protecting their family in the future, I don't like it that as soon as William showed up, Connor got dumped. If they're trying to rebuild OTA and, you know, and everything like that, Connor should be included, but it's also an indication that Diggle and anyone in his family isn't as important, which is always frustrating. And then Zoe also disappeared, but that's, like, a different matter.
Okay, first off, I just want to say, like, Felicity and Oliver talking about wanting to keep their family safe, but still don't even contemplate moving out of Star City. Like, hello? That would obviously be one way to do it. But anyway, I, like, at first I was impressed by Oliver wanting to do things by the book, telling people that they were going to cooperate, you know? And that made sense because it's what he's been doing for weeks already. Like, we've, right. Ever since he joined SCPD, like, we haven't had this kind of clash, really. So now suddenly they're there and he flips so fast. And we're supposed to believe that the flip is because of the baby, even though he said in the first place that he wanted to go by the book for the baby. So, like, how is flipping going to be any safer? Especially when you've been acting like a vigilante for 6 years and that's what sent you to jail in the first place, right? So, like, the options are play by the police rules and try to make the city safe that way, or don't play by the police rules and go to jail and do not collect $200 and do not pass out. So I don't understand. Your child is obviously not going to succeed if you go that second route. So it just didn't, it was, like, not logical. Plus, in a real, like, from a real world perspective, when an Arrow, you know, as much as it is, like, a superhero show, like, it's the most grounded of them because it doesn't have powers, right? But, like, police brutality, excessive force, torture, illegal searches, like, these are things that the police do in real life that are bad, that we're trying to avoid, right? So there's no way that you're going to make me think that a vigilante is superior to police officer because he does those things. Like, that's not why I want a vigilante. And obviously, I get that the bad guys that they face in this show are, like, super, like, overpowered, you know, like, most definitely the worst scum of the earth. So, like, yeah, sure, you can do all those things to them, I guess. That's fine. But what if, now that you're working with the police, you come across someone who could be innocent? You don't know, right? They're a suspect. not everyone that's a suspect is just automatically electric chair. So that's where you run into huge problems and why you need to fix the legal system in the first place, right? So yeah, I don't like that. It takes me out of the show to have, like, in general, it takes me out of the show to have the Team Arrow working with the police, but in this episode especially, because they were trying to posit their way as the better way. And I was like, how? There's no way. It can't be better. Anyway, Felicity annoyed me much less than Oliver did because she doesn't have any real power in that situation. And like the things that she's threatening to do are like hack more, but still, again, the superior attitude felt like it was out of place. It felt like it belonged to season one or two Felicity, who doesn't really know what she's doing when she says the things she says, right? Who has no filter. But, like, you know, you have a baby. You don't want your husband to go back to jail, right? So why are you like, hey, I'm going to do these illegal things, police officers. Can I do the illegal things yet? Can I? No. Why would you say
this?
Isn't
that why Oliver got sent to jail?
Exactly. Like, I just don't understand. Like, I guess it's like they're like trying to be funny or whatever, but I was just like, what alternate universe are we living in? It doesn't make sense to be doing these things and then say you're also doing it to protect your child. You're not doing a very good job. Anyway, I'm also, like I said, I was super glad that we got back to the bunker because the police station situation is untenable and unbelievable. But the way we get back to the bunker is just not realistic, .gif, right? Like, what is this black ops? Why would they be like, yes, we are going to just have this whole separate, like, extra SWAT team. And, like, Dinah is the new Colonel Haley, I guess. And she'll just make sure y'all don't get too crazy. I don't know. Like, what is the supervision? What are they planning to do? It's like the show wants to have its cake and eat it too. Like, it doesn't want to actually change the status quo, but it wants to act like something is different. And you're like, what is different? Nothing is different. So whatever. That's fine.
And also, where are they getting the money to rebuild?
Yeah, I mean, there you go. So many questions. Anyway, so I was very sad that Connor and Zoe were like thrown away this episode, but I can understand why, because again, the show is about Oliver, you know, so Oliver's kids are the ones that are going to get the spotlight. So whatever. But I was like underwhelmed by the fact that William and Mia, like, all they did this episode was track down this cassette player, and like they had to have this like whole like orchestrated drama to get this cassette player from this guy. And I was like, it can't be that hard. But anyway, and then we finally get Felicity's message, and it was just like, I love you guys. I'm sorry I did that thing. Here are some coordinates. And I was like, oh, that's what, okay. It felt super anticlimactic. Like, I'm excited for, you know, when they go over the wall or whatever, right? But for now, I was like, okay, thank you. And then finally, like, this is sort of like, you know, when we were like waiting in trepidation to find out like what reason Iris had to block Nora's powers and to lie to her, blah, 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 you know? And it's like, what can justify this? I'm concerned how they're going to portray it. And that's like how I feel about Felicity and the separating of the kids, except it's like worse here just because I don't have a situation already in my mind where I could imagine why she would need to separate the kids and not tell them about each other. It just seems super like, it's one thing if it's like, okay, she didn't like tell Mia the whole story about her dad, or she didn't tell anyone else about Mia because she doesn't want her to be found out. But like, why couldn't Mia know about William? Like, I don't.
Yeah.
So I'm waiting with trepidation to find out what that is going to be.
I'm not going to say that. What I will say is my dislikes. And like, while I do understand the driving force between the decisions that Felicity made in this episode, you know, with the whole baby being on the way and you kind of feeling kind of the pressure and panicking a little bit about wanting to make sure that the city is safe. And, you know, it's not this way with the police is too slow. So let's go back to what's easy. But still, I think they came off as assholes for most of it, the episode. I really liked initially when Oliver was explaining to Felicity how he wanted to try and make the partnership work you know, they don't like it, but they have to try to make the partnership work for the benefit of their family. But the only problem is at the first sign of complication, you know, he reverts back to his old ways of doing things his way and completely like undermining the not only the SCPD, but also Dinah. And like you guys said, like he's been working with the SCPD for weeks now. And so the kind of idea that this partnership is suddenly new to him and that he doesn't want to do it anymore is a little bit, you know, of a whiplash kind of thing. And the thing with Oliver is like, this is a man that's known Quentin, a police detective who turned into police captain for over half of his life. You know, Oliver was the mayor of Star City for a whole ass year. He dated Laurel, E1 Laurel, who was a DA. He's been to jail. You know, like he knows how the law works from every single angle of this justice system. Like he's been on all sides of it. And so like, you know, I know he knows how the law works. Like he's been like vigilante part as well. Throw that in there. So he's come at the justice system from all sides. And it doesn't make sense to me, while even though I know that he doesn't like the red tape, he wouldn't understand that coercing a confession was not going to stick in court. Like you cannot threaten to put someone in acid and think that their confession is going to stick. And to be honest, I wish the show had spent more time just in general over the course of the series on the legalities of Team Arrow arrests over the years. Because like the Midas guy in this episode can't be the first one to try and vacate his arrest or conviction because it was done illegally. And I don't know. I don't see, like, even if Oliver and Felicity wanted to speed up the process of cleaning up the city, how they thought that they were going to be able to do that and get these confessions and arrests to stick with like using legal methods. Like it doesn't really make sense. But whereas for like, I know, like, I guess Tati thought Felicity like annoyed her less. She actually kind of annoyed me more because I feel like she didn't even try from the beginning. Like Oliver at least tried to do it the right way in the beginning, but Felicity had this kind of like superiority look at, you know, like May said, like we get it, like their computers are slow and Felicity is smart, and you know, but seeing as how like the safety and stability were top priorities on her checklist, I don't get the rush to get it done quickly, because when you rush things, like there's a lot of mistakes that are made. And it doesn't get done right. Like you either do it right and take the time to do it right, or you rush it and you get Star City 2049 with your kids not knowing who each other are and the Glades rising up and Star City being trash. So, you know, there you go. And also like, I don't get like her rushed timeline and her sense of panic, in the sense that her nightmare was Diaz. And the thing that scared her the most about raising children, having a family with Oliver, was Diaz in the background waiting to kill her. And Diaz has been taken care of. Like, they probably don't know that he's dead, but they know that he's in jail. They know mm-hmm. that they've taken him out of the equation. So what are you worried about now? Right. Why is there still this rush to, like, clean up the city?
It feels like it's a justification to get her right to where she is in the flash forward, but.
Right. And then because like outside of Diggle, and they like Diggle had to like pry the secret out of them. But outside of him, Elicity didn't tell any of their friends about their pregnancy. So all of their like rash decision making just makes them seem like elitists who think that they're better than the police. And it doesn't really, and I kind of find it like annoying that, you know, Renee was like, yeah, Elicity is right, instead of being like, why are y'all rushing? And, you know, there's, I don't know, like their decisions from the outside without knowing the reasons why don't make sense. And so I didn't like the fact that the other characters were pretending like they made sense and that, you know, their actions were making things worse rather than better. But Dinah felt the need to apologize to them when they didn't even, you know, let her in to kind of see like where they were coming from or why that they felt that they needed to do that. Like Dinah was just doing her job. So I don't really see why she needed to apologize to them for them not doing their job. So
mm-hmm.
anyways,
I feel you.
Predictions.
The birth won't happen in the crossover. That's all.
Right. I mean, we're seeing the birth in some way next episode. Obviously, yeah. That's still a flash forward. But it doesn't seem like it's happening
now.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it's happening during the end of the world.
Exactly.
As we know.
Yeah, and I totally agree with that. Like, the fact that they're showing any part, like, I know, like, the next episode is supposed to be, like, very, like, Mia and her growth and her childhood and growing up and all that kind of stuff. But the fact that they're showing any part of the birth in Arrow, whether it's a flash forward or not, just makes me think that it's not going to happen during the crossover, because that's something that you would save for the crossover and not for, you know, not preview it in a whole other season beforehand. I'm still on. Oh, May, you left out the part of Shang's email where he agreed with me that I'm right, that Oliver dies in season finale. So.
Oh, I did say it was long, so I was trying to, like, not spend 45 minutes on the thing. But yes, Shang does agree.
Shang validated my theory. And I think, like, I'm still rocking this theory because, one, I can, because, two, because I can. But the fact that, you know, with the whole, like, Oliver and giving birth in this secluded cabin in a non-apocalyptic setting is one. And they're showing the birth now, which means it doesn't happen during the crossover. To me, I think, like, that's what that means. It most likely happens in the season 7 finale or the season 8 premiere, in which case my prediction would change to Oliver dying in season 8 before the crossover. But depending on how far along Felicity is for me going to determine when she has birth, because we still don't know how far along she is when the doctor called. And then also the whole Connor Hawk of it all, because why would Diggle adopt Ben's son instead of Oliver unless Oliver can't, because Oliver is dead? I feel like, I have a feeling that Dante is going to kill Ben sometime before the end of the season, because Ben snitched on Emiko for killing Diaz, Laurel. Before Laurel can get Ben out, Dante is going to have him killed, and Connor's going to be an orphan. And I feel like if Oliver was alive, because they connected during their prison time and they kind of formed a relationship, you know, enemies to trusted friends, well, not trusted, but, you know, friendly acquaintances or whatever. But right, Oliver made, like, this promise to Ben that he was going to take care of him and get him out and do right by Ben. But he can't do right by Ben because Dante kills Ben. So, and I think if Oliver was alive, I feel like he would have thought that the right thing to do would to be to take Connor in. And then he and Felicity would have Connor and Mia and William somewhere off in the background. But the fact that Oliver is no longer in the picture, I feel like in his place, Diggle would step in to take Connor. And I would throw in Laurel as a potential foster parent. So the fact that it wound up being Diggle is also a little bit suspicious about Laurel. But
then what do we predict happens to JJ in the future? Is he just not?
I don't think anything happens to him. I think he's just not in the business of, you know, whatever the hell Connor and Black Star were in the business of.
I think Lila got JJ in the divorce.
Y'all.
Okay. Side A, Lady with Gumption nominations. Dinah.
Like Supergirl.
Dinah, definitely.
Yes, Dinah for Arrow.
And then I guess Alex for Supergirl? I feel like everyone was... Nia, sure. Yeah. Yeah, Nia was having some fun.
I like her, like, oh, I'm a Supergirl.
But I feel like Alex had to fight against something she didn't want to do, and then...
That's true.
Yeah. And then actually, like, sort of had that moment where she's like, you know what, fuck you.
Right.
So basically what we're saying, that side A is definitely Dinah.
Dinah. Yeah, so we're saying side A is definitely Dinah.
So we're moving on to side B, which is the Flash, Black Lightning, and Doom Patrol. Pep Talks / Harambee's Code / Would-Be Messiah. And we are going to kick it off with the Flash, Failure is an Orphan. The Metacure is ready to use on Cicada. With the Metahuman Cure ready to use, Barry and Team Flash must figure out a way to subdue Cicada long enough to take it. Subdue as in...
I heard subdue him... Cicada.
It did, yeah. Cicada. They were kind of trying to seduce them. They were kind of trying to get him on their side.
Seduce him with words.
Exactly.
Long enough for him to consider taking the cure. Killer Frost steps in to help with the plan. because that's useful information to know in a recap.
Did she do that?
Well, she like put on a hoodie and pretended to be someone that Cicada wanted to take out. So I guess she helped. Meanwhile, Joe eases back into work and has a little bit of work issues with Cecile. And Nora isn't happy about the way her dad plans to stop Cicada because it's not her way. And she is really concerned about this one plan that she claims that she had from the beginning, which we know is not really the case. But we're not going to get into that at the moment because Iris is also very, feels like she's up against the clock about wanting to having time to spend with Nora before she gets to go back. And that is also something that happens in this episode. So this episode was written by Zach Stentz and directed by Viet Nguyen. And what did we like about this episode?
First, bless Zach Stentz for actually writing a strong episode. I don't think that I can currently remember the last like strong episode of the season after 12. Like I can't even remember 13. And then I didn't like 14 or 15 all that much. So yay, we're a little bit back on track. And I thought it was a really nicely balanced episode, especially for the West Allen family. It felt like everyone had like their own little journey and that in some way was connected to this plan to stop Cicada, which I thought was great. Like I really liked how we got to see more of the Iris and Nora dynamic. We got to see how much they've grown as a mother-daughter unit since it started. but there's still the like barrier of communication that clearly has been an issue like all of Nora's life, not really understanding what Iris is feeling. But when Iris is able to open up to her and explain what she's afraid of, right? If, like she's scared of not getting to see her daughter like this for decades. Then Nora is able to be more sympathetic and actually try to reach out to her mom and, you know, treat her the way that she always does her dad. So yeah, I really like that. And I thought that Barry got to show off how much he's grown too in the scenes with Joe, which was really nice to get Joe and Barry moments because like last week we got Joe and Iris moments after an extended vacation. And it feels like we haven't had Joe and Barry in a really long time as well. You know, aside from Jesse just not being available. But it's been a while since Joe really got to be a parent to those kids and not to the imaginary baby that never shows up. So I really liked them both giving each other advice that was really useful for their respective situations. And I liked how Barry's advice was reliant on his own relationship with Iris and how they are equals. You know, we are the Flash. They didn't actually say it, which is something we'll talk about in our dislikes again, even though I've already said it. But as a viewer, I know that it's connected to his relationship with Iris, and that's why he's able to give such good advice to Joe. Speaking of Joe, I really loved that we got to see him in like doing his job fully, which is something that we almost never get to see. And that Cecile was like so excited to hop on board. It's always great to see her enthusiasm, both for her job and for her powers, which I think is always so much fun. So once again, like Joe's insecurities about Cecile reared their ugly head. And I like that it's a through line. Like even last season, he was feeling some type of way about her powers on a personal level because he didn't like feeling vulnerable around her, right? Like that toxic masculinity thing where it's like, no, I have to be strong all the time. And so we got over that and now it comes back again, but on a professional level where he's feeling jealous that Cecile is better, like can do his job with, you know, better abilities than he can because he's just using his gut, right? And I liked that he apologized for that he corrected that, and then he, you know, they took it upon themselves to extract the necessary information from Dr. Ombres that got us Cicada. So again, I really like how we get to see, obviously Cecile has power, so you're still getting the information with powers, but we got to see some real like detective work, you know, some real like investigative work that led us to defeat this version of Cicada and not just like, well, let's meet Cicada 300 times and try 300 different speeches until one of them works. which we were in danger of.
Like the Nora way of like,
exactly.
Time, 52 times.
Yes, exactly. And also speaking of investigative work, I was really happy that we got that, even though it was just one scene, we got to see Iris continuing on her newspaper work, you know? And I liked the little moment of teamwork with her and Barry where he brought her the document that she needed while she was on the phone. So that was really cute. Yeah, so that's like all my West Allen family stuff. I also, we'll talk about that one in the slides. Cause like, I think the Barry and Nora one was a little weaker than the rest, but once Dr. Ombres revealed that Grace was a metahuman, cause I had forgotten that the characters didn't know that via osmosis. I didn't just give them that information. So they had to learn it from someone. So once they found that out, everything, like the pieces fell into place, right? We have to see like, okay, that's how you're going to reach Cicada. So I liked how Barry took that information and synthesized it with family is the most important thing to me and also to Cicada. And then he gave a really powerful speech that did not require him taking off his mask, but that's okay. And I thought that was Grant's best work since episode 12. Again, so it was
the chemist
nice.
Moment in 13 didn't work for you, huh?
Oh, that's right. But that's different. That's like, you know, that's like play acting. It's like, oh, I'm going to, which was a lot of fun to see. But this was like, I felt the sincerity of Barry's emotions when he was trying to reach Cicada with the talk about race. So that was great. Also, I really liked that scene where he was like listening to Nora and Iris talk, just because I sort of like, again, it gave me that feeling of just like, well, this is what you're going to be missing, you know, even though the show will not address the elephant in the room. But that is how I felt about it. I also love Grace as Cicada.
Yeah.
Grace Cicada is the superior Cicada. The superior Cicada. I liked her entrance. You know, it was tense and it was scary and it made her seem real. And I liked how it was just something that was totally like unavoidable, right? Like it had nothing to do with what Barry had done that episode or what anyone had done, what steps anyone had taken, right? There was no way to predict that Grace would suddenly also come from the future and be the new Cicada, you know, cause it's not even like, this Grace, our Grace woke up or whatever. So yeah, I thought that was an interesting way of handling the situation. I think that's all. There was like other like cute moments that were like, you know, like there was like levity in the episode, even though it was tense. And that comes from, I think, Zach's writing and the actor's ability to sort of like go with the flow when they get writing that's already good writing.
It's beautiful.
Mm-mm, good writing.
Were those all your, likes, Madir?
That's the end of my likes, yes.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I agree with a lot of your likes. And I think this was one of the strongest episodes in the back half of the season so far. And it was really nice to have Zach Stentz back. I think he wrote a really great episode that balanced character moments with intense action. I think he just really understands the characters. Like, there was never a boring moment, and that's because the pacing was just so well done. And I love that the West and West Allen families got their time to shine in individual subplots. I especially love the moment when Barry and Iris walk into the Cortex and realize that Nora is driving everyone crazy and that they were able to communicate with each other with only their expressions to come up with a plan to get rid of her. It was A+ parenting. And then Barry and Iris were also being really cute when it came to their list of wanting to make memories with Nora. And I love that they embarrassed her with their excitement over her espresso drink. I also really appreciated the fact that Iris still got to be shown working and that the case had to do with last week's episode. So they referenced Gorilla Grodd. And I really love the return of Barry and Joe's heart-to-hearts as well, and how Barry's advice is indicative of how much more mature he's become since season one. I think telling Joe that Cecile's strengths were his strengths and vice versa really paralleled what he said to Iris last season, that they were better and stronger together after she published her article on DeVoe. It was also nice that Barry showcased himself to be a man who is learning from his wife and has a strong and equal partnership with her and is now able to stand and tell someone like Joe, who has exhibited stereotypically toxic male behavior in the past, that he doesn't have to feel threatened by his girlfriend's abilities. And I think that's really important for people to see from a superhero. And I also continue to love how much they're showcasing Iris's point of view. I can't reiterate that enough because that wasn't the case before, most especially in the first two or three-ish seasons. She got some great stuff with Nora and really got to sit with her sadness that Nora would be leaving them soon. Like, she's been so excited from the start to have her around, and I felt the weight of the emotions Iris was feeling over the fact that Nora wouldn't be around forever, at least not like the way that they know her now. And a bonus was Barry listening in on their conversation, but giving them space before interrupting and letting them in on what he was going to do. I also thought Barry saying he'd do anything for Nora came more naturally this time in comparison to the episode like Seeing Red. When he gave his speech to Cicada the second time, I really felt how much he loved and cared for Nora. I think it also showed his enthusiasm for the list of things they do together and how he was impressed that she had put together all the evidence so they could track Cicada. It truly felt like he was a dad and a proud one at that. And this is, I'm not actually sure why it took them so long to try and see if any of the doctors knew or were working with Cicada before, but I am glad that the plot finally picked up in the episode and in a big way. I'm glad that even though another Cicada did show up, that Orlin's version actually was defeated this episode, meaning Barry's plan did work, and I think that's great because he hasn't had a win in so long. And the introduction of Grace as Cicada was really strong. She was badass, scary. She knew how to attack everyone without the use of the metahuman dagger. And she was just brutal and vicious, making her the Cicada that we have deserved from the very beginning. Like, her presence even made Thawne nervous. So even though he didn't know it was her, so she's already iconic to me.
She's ironic.
I can't speak words.
Yes, like, Zach did a great job of putting a little bit of life back into a show that's on creative life support, I feel like. So, you know, his episode was a really definite breath of fresh air, solid writing. And I know they did some rewrites. I praised Zach on Twitter. So it's like, thank you, Zach, for giving Grandma Esther a recipe of food that Black people actually eat. Because Iris wanted to teach Nora, like, Grandma Esther's sweet potato pie recipe. I'm like, yes, that is a Black person food. But I don't know if, like, maybe Eric rewrote that in there. I don't know. But anyway, you know, just like, there was a lot of comedic timing. The West Allen family had some great content. Iris got a little bit of CC, Central City Citizen. There's a nice subplot with Nora. Jocelyn working together as a team. Joe recognizing and then correcting his toxic masculinity. We get Joe Barry having a heart-to-heart, turning into a Barry Joe heart-to-heart with a Barry, you know, drawing on the partnership he has with his wife to help Joe's relationship with his baby mama. So all of that is just, you know, really good and connected and hit the right notes in this episode. And then we also get Grace Cicada, the superior Cicada, finally showing up. So, like, a lot of good things. I know some people were down on the one thing that we didn't get, the one plotline that we didn't get, but a lot of good things really did happen in this episode, and it is a really solid episode. I like the opening of the sequence of Barry helping Iris shake down whoever she was shaking down about, like, the Grodd, not acts of Grodd, should be covered under insurance or whatever she was doing. So I really liked them working together on that, and then that kind of, like, opening up into the whole scene with, like, Nora, who is definitely channeling a lot of her mother's energy. And she's, like, commanding Star Labs team to, like, get in gear and, you know, let's find Cicada and, you know, kind of, like, bossing everybody around because she was on deck. And then, like, Cisco and Sherlock being put off by Nora's sudden bossiness and blaming it on West Allen was really funny. You know, like, the plot that I said people were kind of disappointed we didn't get, the unbirthday plot that Zach mentioned on Twitter, which included, like, the risque joke and jitters. Basically, I thought when originally, like, Barry and Iris were excited to get Nora to jitters, I thought it was because they were going to celebrate her birthday. And then I was like, how would they know it's her birthday? And so, yeah, apparently it was supposed to be, like, a little birthday plot and that's kind of how like the joke comes in, because they don't want to really know like when she's born, because that kind of like knowing when she was born means she knows when she was conceived and all this kind of stuff. And the only thing that I'm probably sad about is the fact that it deprived us of Barry singing to Nora and Iris. But other than that, I feel like celebrating getting your own ex espresso on the menu was also very important and equally a cute family scene. And Iris and Barry coming up with a list of things to do with Nora before she had to leave was really adorable. And it kind of just shows, I wish we had seen like more of that. Like, I agree that I wish we had had episodes of this list and wanting to check things off, like going ice skating could have been a thing on the list, you know? So if we had that list of things before this episode, I feel like it could have just like been, increased the Iris's, kind of sadness at the fact that Nora's leaving soon. Like, I understand the reason why, as Zach stated, for that change to have occurred, because like a birthday plot is really cute and very happy and very positive, but it would feel off center with like the Grace Kata plot and ramping up the reveal of Thawne working with Nora and all that kind of stuff. So I'm satisfied with what we got in exchange. Orlin is finally being done and over with, and Grace Kata is coming in and kicking ass and taking names. Like, I cannot tell you how much I enjoyed seeing Grace bust in the Star Labs and just start tearing shit up. It was amazing. And like, I feel like, why do we have to wait 16 episodes for this? You know, considering that it's only episode 16, I guess we could say that the Flash writers are ahead of schedule, because and on their normal pace, she may come in around episode like 19 or 20 or whatever.
Yeah, that's true.
So, in one way, they are kind of speeding up their reveal, even though Orlin dragged forever. But seeing like Grace mow down all of Team Flash like it was nothing was almost like the equivalent of Zoom dragging Barry like all over some citizen like he was a rag doll. Like, that's how like exciting it was. Like, I know I'm cheering for a villain. I was like, yes, fuck it up, fuck it up, little sis, let's go. So it's just kind of like, you know, the joy of like actually enjoying a villain on the show again was great. Like, I stand one little murderous child. Go, Grace, go. And although, like, as I alluded to before, what I really liked about Joe Steele's team up is that Joe recognized his saltiness was not because Cecile was being extra, which Cecile is an extra girl. Like, she's with her powers, especially like with her powers being what they are, like even like I could understand like Joe not wanting to be vulnerable about her, but just like in general, she's very extra with expressing her powers. But like his deal wasn't because she was being super obvious about here rubbing my ring, Joe, she's lying. But it was the fact that, you know, he was salty that she was better at something than he was. And so I like that at least he recognized that that's what he was doing and that he didn't want to be that way. And so, you know, that kind of recognizing his toxic masculinity and then deciding to like change it or, you know, apologize for it, I thought was really, you know, a really good line or development for him. And I like that Barry's response to Joe and his relationship advice to Joe was that their relationship is partnership and that each person is there to complement and make the other person stronger, which is exactly how he and Iris function as a team. And, you know, like I said, like Tati and both you and May mentioned, like he didn't specifically say him and Iris, which he could have. They could have written that in. But it's also, I think, it should go without saying, because, you know, Barry's thinking about what he always thinks about, which is Iris. But it would have been nice to have that like explicitly stated as well. But what did we not like about this episode?
That. the first thing I didn't like was I was getting impatient when Barry couldn't come up with the thing that he could connect to Cicada with. And I understand that it's because they did not yet have the information about Grace being a metahuman, but the fact that no one even thought of Grace was very strange to me. And Legacy was also like along the nose. Like it was just like, well, that's Todd's keyword for the season. So obviously Barry's going to talk about legacy, but it has nothing whatsoever to do with Cicada. Unless you had tied that legacy directly to Grace and said, what is Grace going to feel like when she wakes up and she finds out that her uncle is in jail for being a serial killer? That's the only way to have done it. And then he could be like, well, my daughter is also a crazy xenophobe, so she will be fine with it. And then that would be, that would be one thing. But they did not go that route. So I was a little impatient. And then I got over it once Dr. Ombre's revealed the truth about Grace, but it's still, I think that, Zach was hampered by the fact that he wasn't allowed to use that card until it was revealed. So that made the first half of the episode seem a little bit off kilter. Aside from that, I understand the issue with Barry and Iris. Like, I totally wish that we got more like cute, touchy, feely moments between Barry and Iris, even if they didn't kiss. Because like, that's not, I'm not like a, I need to see them kissing, but it would be nice to see them just like acting more like a married couple together in alone scenes. But I really think that it's a matter of the writers not being able to walk and chew gum at the same time. Because like on the reverse, which nobody cares about, but I'm going to talk about anyway, Joe and Cecile are like being great partners right now. They're totally being like a super married cute honeymoon couple. Super cute. Yeah. But they don't got no child. Yeah. Where is their baby? She doesn't exist anymore. Okay, so like, does she even have a babysitter? Is she just sitting alone in that home? Like, we don't know. We don't know. And that's after like 8 weeks of her not appearing at all because she was off in Tibet with Joe. Like, Joe took a newborn child to Tibet to hang out with Wally. And so, yeah, they just bottled Cecile's milk for it. Okay, it's fine. It's fine.
She sends it through a portal, like opens up a portal to Tibet.
She sends all the milk through.
It just doesn't like so. Like, it's equally as nonsensical that Joe and Cecile are not focusing on their child at all as it is that Barry and Iris are not focusing on their relationship. But it's because they want to show Barry and Iris' parents, and they want to show Joe and Cecile getting into their relationship. So, unfortunately for us, that is how it is right now. And everyone will breathe a sigh of relief when Nora goes back to her home time, because then Barry and Iris' lips will touch once more. I guarantee you. Okay. But that being said, do wish is that they could have dialogue from Barry, from Iris, talking about their married life and them as a married couple to remind us, you know, that they are still in love, even though we're not seeing it. But on the bright side, I can use that as proof that it's not Grant and Candace hating each other. It is the writer. So I guess it all works out. Anyway.
Yeah, well, especially since the last time when we did see it, it was like very prevalent in the crossover and a couple episodes before. So like all of a sudden for it to shift.
Right.
Makes no sense to me. So,
yeah. So anyway, aside from that, I would say the other dislikes were like, I wish that Ombre's hadn't died. I know we heard that we're going to find out why she had to kill her next episode or whatever, but yeah. I don't. I liked her moral ambiguity and like her like unethical methods. And I like that this is like episode we really got to see like how much she cares about Grace and Orlin, you know, and that she will sometimes do the right thing. For their benefit, right? She doesn't only do bad things. So yeah, I'm sad that she's gone. I think that's about it.
All wonderful dislikes.
Thank you.
I know the episode was set up so Barry does have an epiphany later about appealing to Cicada by way of Grace, because that was his original idea at the end of 5/11. So to have him try and appeal to Cicada's legacy was strange, given that it would be obvious Orlin wouldn't care about that at all, just like you said, Tati. And it's not as big of a dislike, mainly because of the addition of Grace being a meta, changed a bit of the conversation, so it worked out anyway. But it also did take too long. Like, no one brought it up at all, and that's just strange to me. And I didn't like that Ambrose had to die. Like, we finally got to the point where we understood why she was helping Orlin, and then Grace straight up murdered her. And like we discovered things about her fiance and why she personally disliked Meadows. And I thought that like Grace murdering someone who used to take care of her was really terrible. And I don't know that her excuse is really going to make up for that. And then like, other than that, there wasn't a lot I disliked about this episode. I mean, I could have used more, you know, West Island one-on-one scenes, but I feel like this episode was so strong that it didn't really bother me. But I did roll my eyes at Barry revealing himself to another Meta, a Meta who has been after him and who knows his family. What if it had gone sideways, you know? So this is the millionth time Barry's revealed his identity to someone and brought them to Star Labs, and I'm starting to wonder how drunk I'd get if someone made a video of every time Barry pulled off his cowl in front of a Meta and I took a shot. And then I do wish we'd gotten Barry's line about him and Iris practicing sex joke and him singing to Iris Sonora, but I'm not, like I said, I'm not as upset about it because we got such a great episode. And I hope that they think about those scenes later so that they can put them in like near the end and like right before Nora leaves, Barry could sing to them. That would be really sweet.
Yeah, I hope that because like I understand why Zach shared on Twitter because he kind of like already promised that he would, but I hope that him sharing that potential plot doesn't mean that they can't use it later as an actual plot because it could still work. But I don't know if they will do it now since he already said it, but I never want to hear another living soul complain about Iris being mad that Barry lied to her all damn season about being the Flash because clearly Barry has no problem revealing himself to people that legit want to kill him. It's frustrating. And I feel like he definitely could have, like he was selling it to Cicada with the mask on. Like he didn't really have to go that extra step. Like, and I feel like I shouldn't be, like I should have expected it. Like, you know, why am I gasping? I already knew that. Because they were clearly setting it up with like Joe saying, be more human, be more Barry Allen. I'm like, Joe, shut up. But so I knew it was coming, but I still just feel like it's just extra for no reason. Like, I really don't know why at the point they just don't make Barry like full Wally and have his identity be public already. Because like, who exactly is he hiding it from? Like, he's not hiding it from villains because he shows his face to all of them. So why exactly is his secret identity still being, you know, has to be a secret? I don't really understand if he's just going to like expose himself to every villain that wants to kill him. And I low key, like I am a little bit annoyed that every problem on the Flash has to like be solved with the power of love. sometimes it does make it seem like things are a little bit too easy or wrapped up a little bit too easily. Supergirl is kind of like the same thing. All you need is love, kind of, you know, whatever. RIP to Dr. Ambrose. I agree with y'all that I didn't like that she had to die because she was the only one that was like riding for Orland day one. And I guess we'll figure out, like, I guess like Grace Kata is probably sees Dr. Ambrose helping Orlin take the cure as like a betrayal or whatever. And I guess that's why she had to kill her. But I still, you know, I still think it was not of the list of people in Star Labs to kill. Like, I don't think that Dr. Ambrose needed to be like at the top of that list for her. Yeah. I guess like Grace just said, snitches get stitches. Done with it. anyways, predictions.
I mean, I'm going to predict that Eobard is behind Grace Kata, right? Because.
Do you think so?
Because I don't know how else she could have come back.
Well, I don't know why he would be like confused that the future is changing unless.
I don't think he is confused.
You think he's trying to be confused?
Yeah.
I will tell you one thing. He is definitely getting blonder. Like, I thought it was just my imagination, but like.
He's getting blonder?
Yeah. His hair is getting blonder. My prediction is that Matt's coming back.
The mystery. He's turning into Matt.
He's turning into Matt. I would love to listen to like my delusional thinking, but that he's is definitely the getting blonder.
Yeah. All right. I mean, and we still don't know why the clock is running out.
Yeah. Yeah, we do not. So yeah, I mean, that's really my only thing is that I think that he's somehow behind Grace Cicada and that somehow ties into his larger plot because he must want to do something to hurt Barry. So I don't.
Do you think he like built it up so that he like built up Nora to go back in time and do some stuff and then he sent Grace after Nora to tie up loose ends?
Maybe.
Hoping that she kills Nora in the past so he doesn't have to deal with her anymore.
I mean, sometimes I wonder if he's just, like, so angry that he just wants to, like, he's fucking with Nora to create obstacles that will somehow erase her maybe from the timeline.
So right. I mean, I think really, he's like, hoping.
Stick it into Barry.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I do think that he wants to erase Nora from the timeline. But I think that Grace as Cicada is there more to, like, you know, get rid of Barry or to hurt Barry or whatever in some way. Not that she specifically will kill Nora, but that fucking with time enough will make Nora go away.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And dark.
I mean, I guess the only minor prediction is that the reveal isn't going to come until the end of next episode.
Oh, that would suck. But yeah. It's probably going to be. Because it has to lead into episode 18.
Right.
And Barry being so pissed off that he's going to, like, run and kick Thawne's ass in the future.
Good times.
Moving on to Black Lightning. Season finale part one. Lynn counsels former pod kid Wendy, in how to live in a world that's new to her, but the fate of the other pod kids remains in doubt. Meanwhile, Anissa figures out Grace's secret. And lastly, Jefferson tries to install a superhero code for his metahuman offspring, but Jennifer insists on taking revenge on Tobias for her boyfriend's death. And on the villain side, Tobias is getting his metahuman trafficking ring up and running with the help of Dr. Jace and his girlfriend Cutter. And that is what you missed on Black Lightning. Oh, also, Lala is on a mission to kill Tobias. So that's great. What did you like about this episode?
He's going to do Jefferson's work. I mean, so many things seem to come together this episode. Almost every character got a lead on something, which was great. And I liked seeing Jefferson lay down some ground rules when it came to how he, Jennifer and Anissa would be working together. I think it needed to be said because with each of them having their own thing going on and their separate vendettas, it's important for them to be on the same page. And there was also a very nice sister moment between Jennifer and Anissa before they decided to agree to their dad's terms and I like that Jefferson and Lynn had already discussed it so he wasn't making the decision on his own. I really love that Anissa came to the realization that the man she fought last episode was actually Grace and that she put it together based on her eyes changing color. I also really like that Jefferson saw Jennifer was still struggling to get why it was wrong to go after Tobias and took her out alone to talk to her. And then the scenes where he was remembering her as a little girl were very sweet and adorable and did a good job of showing us his headspace with regards to Jennifer. And I also really like that Lynn called Jennifer so she could come speak with Wendy about having powers. And then mentioned Perenna as well. And it was a very active move on her part. And I really enjoyed the bonding time she got with Wendy. And then we got to see just how much she values Lynn in an environment she doesn't trust in the world she feels she can't go back to. And then finally, I'm glad we got some background story for Lala's continuous resurrections. Like everyone has a vendetta against Tobias and it's all tying in together very nicely for the finale.
Yeah. Bless that random doctor man who was in love with Lady Eve. Because yes, Lady Eve is the best. And she deserves justice. And also, yes, Lala, kill Tobias. I'm so glad that someone agrees that Tobias must die. And we don't care about your heroic code to not kill Tobias. Because he definitely should die. And we've already seen what happens when you put him in jail. And that is nothing. He just gets out and murders people again. So kill him. Kill him, Lala. Anyway, aside from the entirety of Lala and Weirdo Doctor Man, which I enjoyed all of for once, I was like, yes, just because I'm just pumped for that showdown. And I totally like that we're finally getting answers to the mysticism that started last season. You know, that was like a slow burn, but we're finally here. We're finally here. And I am ready for this jelly. On the flip side, on the other hand, I'm very, I was very into the family dynamic this episode. Again, I'm really liking how that's like come back together. I enjoyed Jefferson coming up with the ground rules for the girls. And I liked that he and Lynn did it together as a team, and that Anissa and Jennifer were kind of pushing back as a team. Even if there was different aspects that they disagreed with, it still felt like a family squabble. But one that was resolved, or not quite resolved, but like that they came to an understanding in a realistic way. I also loved that we finally got a chance to see Lynn's motherly tendencies toward Wendy have like a positive effect, and like actually see what Wendy's perspective was, right? How she feels about Lynn. She makes her feel safer. And the offer of bringing in Perenna and also Jennifer to help Wendy, like on a psychological level, I thought was really sweet. What else? This is mostly dislikes, but I was glad that Cape Man got his story told after the fact, like that it was something that people were thinking about. It wasn't just like something we were forced to see and then be like, oh, this is, you know, sad or tragic or scary or whatever. It was something that people, like he as a person, was shown to matter. And also, yeah, I love Anissa still not giving up on Grace, and the fact that she learned that Grace was a shapeshifter made her even more concerned and more like desperate to find her, because she blamed herself for not telling Grace the truth, right? Which I thought was interesting. That she was like, if she knew that I was Thunder, then she would have come to me with her problem, which may or may not be true. I don't know. You know, maybe she would still see herself as a danger to Anissa. We don't know, because we haven't gotten any of Grace's perspective. But it is nice to see Anissa think that way. And I like how it contrasted so starkly from her opinion at the start of the episode, when she was saying like, oh yeah, I would never tell anyone my identity. Duh, that's stupid. But as soon as she thought that it could help Grace to know it, she was like, I should tell her my identity. So that's how that works. And there you go. That's that on that.
Yeah, like I felt like this was a really solid episode. It felt like a season finale part one. All the storylines, except for that Mr. Lowry one that just like disappeared into the abyss. But all the other storylines from this season are converging together in a really nice way. Jeff and Lynn coming together to come up with some ground rules for Anissa and Jen, fighting with him out in the field, felt like some real growth from them and their parenting. Like Anissa and Jen may still feel like they're being like controlled or restricted or whatever, but like this coming from, you know, where Jefferson and Lynn first were when they realized that their kids have powers, to actually being like, okay, we can do this, but let's have some ground rules. I'd rather have you out there with me and know that you're out there rather than you like running around as vigilantes and blackbirds and like collapsing in the middle of the streets, you know? So it just feels like they're finally relaxing and adjusting to this new reality, even if Anissa and Jen are still being a little bit hard-headed about, you know, not wanting to completely conform. In particular, in this episode, I really like Jefferson's dynamic with Jennifer. And I feel like the scene in the bunker when, you know, she's trying on her suit and she's really excited about it. And, you know, he has these like flashbacks of to when she was younger and, you know, a baby, and how everything is changing and his little girl's growing up kind of thing. I thought that was really sweet, you know, like his sappy thoughts. And then even like their daddy-daughter lunch date was really sweet, at least until Jen brought up Tobias. But like everything before that was like really, really sweet. Sweet and cute. I also just in general appreciated Lynn's plot this episode. I know I haven't exactly been feeling her recently because of the whole, I feel like she's only one-dimensional as like the mother. So like, I know like I haven't really been feeling Lynn that much lately because like, I feel like they lean in too much on her as like the motherhood thing and not really giving her like a lot of depth. She felt like really one-dimensional. Like I felt like last week she should have been more the doctor and Wendy's doctor as opposed to, you know, the smothering mother. But in this episode, in particular, I feel like her playing the mother or the guardian for Wendy made more sense and made more practical sense for what she was trying to achieve in securing Wendy's future. Wendy's still a minor. So when it comes to like decisions about her life and, you know, having to work for the government or not, I think Lynn playing the role as a guardian works in this sense for this episode. And I like that she definitely put her foot down with Odell, that Wendy does have a choice, and that she was a mouthpiece for Wendy and what Wendy might like to do or not like to do with her future. And I also like that Lynn was thinking ahead to having Perrina come in and help Wendy, and how she remembered how Perrina helped Jennifer, and even reaching out to Jennifer to be kind of like a meta peer mentor and to kind of like talk through, you know, what it's like to live in this world with powers. So it kind of showed like Lynn, how Lynn's view of, you know, kids with powers has evolved as well. And her relationship with Jennifer and using that to reach out to Wendy, I thought was really good. On a Thunder Grace side, I'm really glad that Anissa caught on pretty quickly to Grace's secret. I'm glad that that's not going to drag out and that, you know, Anissa was able to put two and two together to equal four. And I like that she's not upset about it. Like, she found out the secret and she's not upset, because I like that her default is she thinks that Grace pushed her away to spare Anissa's feelings, like to protect Anissa, and not that Grace pushed her away because Grace was a bad person or Grace was in the wrong or whatever. So I like that, you know, we don't have this manufactured angst of, oh man, I thought Grace is good, but she's actually bad kind of thing. It's not that way at all. So I like that. I like meeting the rest of the Masters of Disaster. I thought that it was fun, if a little bit on the nose, like when Joe, the fire hazard or whatever is fire powers, goes and he's like blowing up them all, and the song, like the fire starts playing. I was like, yes, I've watched enough Hell's Kitchen to know what this song is. you know, it was a little bit on the nose because the song is about fire, and you know, like he's got a fire meta, but you know, it was fun. But the most interesting plot line for me was the Doctor and Lala plot, just because it fits my prediction, but also fills in some gaps that connect back to season one with like justice for Lady Eve. I love the plot twist that this Doctor guy was like in love with her, like they were in a relationship, and it makes sense why he keeps bringing Lala back and putting Lala through like tattoo therapy to get him to this place of preparing him mentally to be ready to kill Tobias and go after Tobias. But that's probably like the most interesting plot of the episode to me. But what did we not like about this episode?
Jennifer's testing my patience. For some reason, my daughter, after hearing her dad say multiple times that revenge and killing is not the way and that her new suit wasn't ready, still thought it would be a good idea for her to go after Tobias alone. Like, she's only got her superhero training wheels on, so I don't know why she thought it was smart to take on a guy who's been doing this for decades and is a known merciless killer. Like, no matter how many ways you slice it, it wasn't going to end well. And at this point, it's become frustrating that they have to stop whatever it is they're doing to save Jennifer, whether it's running away or doing something stupid like going after Tobias. She needs to take a step back. Also, with Jefferson's speeches to her, it might have helped to mention that Tobias had killed their grandfather and he'd spent years trying to catch him, but killing him isn't worth it if it's going to put him and everyone he loves in danger. Because the show seems to have forgotten Jefferson also hates Tobias for personal reasons as well. Tobias and Cutter is still a thing that's happening, and for whatever reason, the scene with them flirting with each other made me cringe a bit, just because it's not something I wanted to see. I also know they were going for realistic and to also show what was happening in Freeland with the Green Light kids, but it was still very hard and brutal to watch the superhero guy be shot in the cold open. I thought that, they were showing police brutality, but like the way that they did it, it was just really hard to watch. Finally, I really want to know what happened to the Markovians. They seem to have disappeared, and I'd like to have an update of what it is they're doing and also how the whole side plot of South Freeland ultimately ties into everything that's happening. So hopefully we'll have some of that in the finale.
I was really uncomfortable with the opening sequence. I felt like, you know, obviously it was hard to watch, and I at first, like, I didn't know why they were starting that way. I know it's like to show the danger of the fear of metahumans. But, like, yeah, I was like, it was like a bit much for me anyway, personally. And also I feel like we've already seen it several times throughout the season. So aside from just like being like extra tragic, I didn't necessarily add to the urgency of the situation for me. Though it was ameliorated by the fact that they did present him throughout the episode, you know, like in newscasts and stuff. Aside from that, I agree about Jennifer, but it's more like for me, the issue was that it didn't feel like it flowed from the previous episode, because the previous episode showed her being like super hyped to get into the costume and like get ready to fight. And then the costume blew up basically and hurt her. And then it seemed like she was much more subdued about it. So I thought that we were going to get a more measured take this episode, but instead it felt like the previous episode didn't happen at all. Like she didn't need that plot because we were just back to where she was right before then. So I don't know. I just kind of felt like they're not really sure how far they want to take Jennifer with this storyline. Because again, like she's been raring to go to kill Tobias since Khalil died. And it's however many episodes later, and it's like, feels like we're still going in the same circle. And that being said, like, as I said, I'm totally for Lala trying to kill Tobias. So I would have no issue with Jennifer wanting to kill Tobias and that being opposed to what her father wants, but her believing it's the right thing to do, because I believe it's the right thing to do. But also, if we actually saw her working towards being able to kill Tobias, just the fact that, like, there's no way that she would successfully be able to do that now. So it just seems like, okay, bratty child, quit your tantrum. But if she was actually shown training to get herself to a place where she could successfully kill Tobias, then I think it would be a more powerful story, because it's, of course, something that Jefferson doesn't want for her, right? Something that her parents and her family would be very worried about, but something that she could reasonably take on, you know? So that's why I think it's just a little bit silly. I also, as I mentioned in my likes, it bothers me that we don't get any of Grace's perspective in these episodes in terms of like why she's hiding from Anissa or like what she really thinks. Like, obviously she doesn't like what's happening and she doesn't want Anissa to know, but like that's, we don't know like how long it's been happening, like how long has she been planning to leave, or like why did it become so untenable that she had to go, or like what is it she thinks Anissa would do? So like all we have is the conjecture by Anissa, and I don't know that there's going to be much resolution in the finale in terms of that. So we will see. I hope there is. And then I also, you know, I'm also not a huge fan of, it's not so much that I'm not a huge fan of Cutter and Tobias, because they can do what they want. But like Jace's reaction to Tobias and Cutter was like super strange. Like she seemed like really mad about it. And then like when she was getting mad about the things Tobias is doing, be like, I could be just as useful as Cutter. Like I'm better than Cutter is. And I was like, what is happening right now? Is this like some weird love triangle? Like, why are you so mad?
Yeah, I thought she was above jealousy.
Yeah. Like I don't know what's going on.
Like I don't know if I would call it like jealousy or whatever, but she definitely, I think it's like a power move. Like she knows that Cutter is like the number two. And so she wants to be like, she doesn't want to like slob Tobias down in front of all their employees.
Right.
Like Cutter did. But you know.
Yeah, and it's not like it's not really a love triangle. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like obviously I don't think it's a real love triangle, but it felt like, I don't know. Jace is basically really overstepping. Like she thinks she's super valuable. And I'm like, you just stepped in off the
street. She's not. Yeah.
So I don't know what you're doing right now.
He basically hinted to Tobias that he needs to kill you soon.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And then finally, the last thing I would say is that I really want some resolution with like Jefferson and the school, and like the fact that the last time that we really got into that storyline, he sort of left it in the hands of raging racist man just because he's cool. Like, I don't like that, and I want to change that, but I don't think that they will. So that bothers me as well. The end.
Yeah, I think with like the opening scene with Cape Guy, we only saw him once before the season. Like they had him like in the pre-scene or whatever. And I think if they were leading to this, having Cape Guy be the story, then I would have liked to have seen him like a little bit of like the kind of Cape Guy, you know, from the beginning of season two or whatever, just like stuff that in earlier part of the season wouldn't have seemed like, why are they have this random like Cape Guy and like, oh yeah, there's Cape Guy, you know, and those little like moments in there. And then you have this episode where this cape guy that we know is just like a wacky, you know, doesn't mean any kind of harm thing, whatever. In addition to what he's saying, because, you know, a lot of the suspense from the episode came off of just what him, like the stuff is happening around him. And he's like, I don't know what's going on. And he's saying it and the police aren't believing him. But I feel like even more of an impact would have been made if we had seen like all these little instances like, oh, that's just Cape Guy. And, you know, you like the police not having an issue with him. And all of a sudden, like now it's an issue, would have had like a bigger payoff and not just let's shoot another black man on TV and call it drama, because isn't this like the real world stricken from the headlines, you know, kind of thing.
Exactly.
It's kind of cheap. Jennifer, yeah, I like the whole, why is it so this driving force for her to kill Tobias, for her to go from like zero to 100, and it's all based on Khalil. And like, I don't really believe in the Jennifer Khalil love story, that it's like a foundation kind of thing. Like, it's not like a, you know, Felicity going after Diaz. Like, I didn't like a lot of stuff that Felicity did when she was in that mode, but it made more sense to me. It was more believable to me why she has gotten to this point, willing to go after Diaz. A little bit less so with Jen, who doesn't really know how to control her powers or anything like that. And I think that as far as the whole killing Tobias question, the reason that Lala is still around, the doctor connected to Lady Eve and all that kind of stuff, is because he is that moral gray area, because they're never going to let Jennifer actually kill Tobias. And I don't like the whole superhero code, and Jefferson can't kill Tobias for the same reason. Like, he went through that in season one. So we know that our heroes cannot kill Tobias, but Lala is like the anti-hero that is allowed to do that. So I really don't have an issue with why can't Jennifer kill Tobias, because she's not supposed to. You don't start off a hero's journey that way. But I do like agree with y'all that I think it's, you know, figuring out a way, like, because right now Jen just seems, someone says Jen no and Jen says Jen yes, and she goes off and does it anyway, and she continues to get like hurt, and it's really like frustrating because she knows she can't control her powers and all of this kind of stuff. So it's, she's kind of like more of an obstacle at this point, and keeping her family from doing stuff that could stop Tobias, because she's always going off and doing it. And it's like people give her really solid reasons about why we can't go about it this way. Like the conversation she had with Anissa a couple episodes ago, when Anissa's like, yes, I am on board with you, but we have to do it in this way. And Jennifer still goes out. Like, those are the kind of things that annoy me about like the whole arc about to kill or not to kill Tobias. I guess that's probably it. I guess like Odell in his little not so subtle hints, just like say that, you know, or I guess it's coming out in the finale or whatever, but you know, it's starting to drag on a little bit. And I agree with Tati about like the school storyline. Like, that was one thing that was a big thing in the beginning of the season and dropped in like the weirdest, not great place. So
right.
And there's no kind of resolution in sight for that. But moving on, because we spent a lot of time on this episode in general, this podcast. Predictions?
I think Glenn is going to find out that Agent Odell knows that her family are superheroes, because he was making it a bit too obvious. And she had the face at the end, and like suspicion face. So I hope that she does find out in the finale.
Tati?
I agree she'll find out, but like, why?
To what purpose? Yeah,
exactly. What is it? What does he have them under surveillance for? Is it just so that he can hold it over her head and be like, if you don't do what I want, I'll tell people?
Or I'll take your kids or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Mine is the same as last week, and it's the most correct one, because Lala will kill Tobias.
Yes.
Then he'll finally be allowed to die.
And I cannot wait.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Finally, we move on to Doom Patrol with the apocalypse. In full swing, the Doom Patrol must work with an unlikely ally and a very special pug to stop the end of the world. We get the return of Mr. Nobody and Niles Calder in the episode. They are the unlikely team to help us stop the apocalypse. And they come up with a plan to dig into Jane's past to find an alternate that is very persuasive in helping us achieve this apocalypse averting recreator. So what do we like about this episode?
I really enjoy, well, first off, I love that it's Jane's time to shine, or just, you know, I call her Jane, but I know that there's 64 of them. So I love that it was Diane Guerrero's time to shine in whatever form she is shining. And I thought that, you know, Mr. Nobody's way of narrating her, you know, the bits of her life that we got to see was, as usual, you know, super snarky and funny, but also like, you get to see really just like how his powers work, like what his omniscience really means. And it's like, oh, well, he doesn't care about how she got her powers, so we don't get to find out how she got her powers. And then literally he can like freeze time, which I thought was really interesting. And also, like, this is the possibly the first time that one of her powers has been like really useful in a really major way. Cause like, obviously her power, you know, before, like, it just like zoomed them to Power Y. But this time it's like it really drives the plot. And we see just like, I don't know, I think it's like just like the vast encompassing of just like all the different kinds of things that she can do. Like she has someone that's like literally like, I don't know, Emma Frost, which is like crazy. I really like Dr. Harrison. I like how it showed Diane's range too. Cause so like this is like probably like the most different of her personas. And also like, not to say realistic, but like, for example, I don't know the name of Oliver Twist's persona, but that one's just like a gag to me. Like, it's just like funny, you know, like, oh, please, sir, may I have some more. But like, this is like a whole, like, it really felt like a whole different identity. Like, I don't know how this could be the same as Jane, which is super interesting to me.
Yeah, because like Hammerhead and the others are like, well, this is Angry Jane and this is Fire Jane.
Yeah, exactly.
This is Night Thorn Jane. But Dr. Harrison actually feels like, oh, this is a different person.
Yeah. So I really enjoyed getting to meet that persona. And also I liked how it was introduced. Like we really got to see this episode, how these other personalities are covering for Kay Challis. And we still don't know what happened to Kay, but, you get like more hints, right? You see that it happened to her when she was a young girl, right? Cause that's why we see Kay as that young girl. And then the doctor who cannot call himself a doctor, but that guy was suggesting that it was like something that, you know, like talking about her childhood trauma. And that's when this super powerful personality came out. So I also really loved the asylum scenes. I liked the dynamic with the different patients and how you see the way that her influence works, but also like the fact that they actually had ideas that she incorporated. So it wasn't just like her controlling these people, like further just control them because okay, we don't care about them, but the people that were like in the same position as her, she really did like listen to them about like making it a dog and like making it invisible ink, which I would love to know how they did, but whatever. You know, and I also like that we got to see just like in miniature a whole other person's heroic arc, like that Marilyn
who
who like Dr. Harrison kind of takes under her wing and like listens to her. And then decades later, she remembers enough and cares enough and has like the ability to track her down to Barcelona, get inside a dead priest, break into the snow globe. And then, you know, like actually like awaken Dr. Harrison and allow them to ring the bell to bring the dog, et cetera. So like that whole thing was a lot of fun. I thought that like it brought a lot of levity to the whole apocalypse plot in a way that maybe the first half of the little two-parter didn't do as much. Like there was I keep calling him Constantine, Willoughby. Willoughby was like humorous and funny, but like the whole situation did not feel that way. Yeah, the whole situation was super dark. And this one felt a lot more like we were climbing back towards the light and you knew it had to turn out well because obviously it wasn't just going to end, but so I think it was like a more enjoyable ride for me than the first half, since the first half has to end in the apocalypse. Now we get to get out of it. I also love that we continue to get that bond between Rita and Elliot, and that she, you know, risked getting eliminated herself in order to go out and find him and make him feel better. And also that she was really affected by him disappearing, and that she was like, you know, still thinking about him, like when it was all over, said and done. She's like, I really hope that he came back, right? And I assume that he did, because we see everyone coming back. So I was like, yay, Elliot, great success. She was like the one that was concerned about another child having to suffer what Elliot did. So like, even though Dr. Harrison did not hear that, it still worked out that it was just a dog. And I assume that no one was torturing the dog. He was just hanging out until his time to shine happened. So yeah, I liked all of that. I also really loved the goodbyes, and actually just like a lot of the moments with Niles Calder, with Chief and his various children. I loved the, even the Larry and Niles moment, and also Willoughby and Niles kind of like reminiscing about their friendship and where it went wrong. And also Victor was still like a little weird this episode, but I liked him and Niles sort of confronting each other. And then at the end, you still see how much Victor cares about him and how far he's willing to go for him to get him back. The Jane and Niles scene at the very end was like my favorite, like when we actually get to see how
him rescue her.
Yes. Yeah. And it was, I was surprised by it, because I was thinking like, oh, they're going to get rid of his personality because it's too powerful. So I thought we were actually going to have to see that. And I was very much not looking forward to that. But instead, Niall saved the day. And we got to see how Jane first, you know, got a home and got a... So I really like that. I felt very emo about that. Is that on that?
I think that's sufficient.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good list of likes.
Yeah, I think I appreciated this episode more because it just had a lot more going for it, and it connected the characters together with the storyline more than the first episode did. And I really like the idea that this episode kind of brought up, that they could just create a new religion, because religion as we know it starts off as an idea, right? With a group of certain followers that spread the word down the line, and it gets passed down from generation to generation. So I really like that, how they you know, got to fuck with time so that they could like recreate the decreator. And I also really liked, my first thought was when this episode ended, it was like, oh, there was a lot less men's backstories, you know, because we didn't have Larry taking over, we didn't have Robot Man taking over. It was mostly about Jane, and Rita got her nice little subplot too. I really loved the Jane bits. Like, I love Dr. Harrison as well. I think she was a great character and a new addition to who we know as Jane. I think that she had this, I don't know what it was, like some kind of aura about her. She was very intelligent. She knew how to manipulate people even without the mind stuff. And also like Tati said, she wasn't also just manipulating the people who were following her. She was also like listening to them and giving and taking ideas with them. So I love that. And I love that Rita still really cared about Elliot, and that she took the time to try to find out if he was okay, and even asked Calder about him at the end. I read the unicorn flirting with Niles. That was really great. I mean, just the whole thing was crazy. Like, they have like 19 minutes to save the world from the apocalypse. And I think that they did a pretty good job with all of it. Even like Willoughby didn't really get on my nerves this time around. And there was, yeah, it was, I think it was just really well paced. And the fact that even Cyborg had his moment with the Chief when he was talking about like how he saw the world about heroes. It wasn't just like gray area for him. There was no gray area. It was just good and bad, which I thought was a little bit ironic given the fact that he hangs out with the Doom Patrol. And I also really like that we learned more about the spirit in that Larry realized that he just maybe he's the one who fucks people over, you know, with his conversation with the chief. And I just liked how much everyone showed that they cared about the chief and that the chief was shown caring about everybody else. Like that end scene with Jane was really poignant and just showed how much like he really wanted to take these people who were just disconnected from society, something traumatic had happened to them, and then bring them to like a safe space. And I thought that was really nice to see. I think I covered everything from my loose notes. Yeah, take it away, Jess.
Okay, well, I forgot to mention last week that that unicorn horse head was like one of my because like she sang like her prophecy to Horse with No Name, which I thought was great. She didn't sing this time, but I just forgot to mention that last week, so I'll just start off saying that I loved it. And I'm glad that it came back. Like the whole flirting with Niall thing was hilarious. I think Victor is still, he's very like rigid, but his stiffness worked well this week from a comedy perspective with the whole like Mr. Nobody vomit shtick with him and the chief and him. Like, you know, like he says the name and then Chief Bobby's like, wait, you mean if I say Mr. Stop? So that worked well, like from a comedic angle. But yeah, like the whole, I really like that this was a Jane episode and that we delve into her past because, you know, for, you know, we had Cliff's in the beginning and then we had Larry's and it's kind of like, well, is this going to be another one of those things where it's just two people of the team that we get into and not everybody else. But so I do like that they delved into Jane's past and then also her past was like a main driving force plot point for what's going on in the present. I like it's her whole backstory is just very interesting, very sad, with how she's just been abused at like the psychiatric hospital. Like she was already abused before she got there because that's how she split up into all these different personalities. But the fact that, you know, these doctors in the psych ward are just awful human beings and, you know, like them closing the door to, you know, repeatedly kick her and stuff like that. And that therapist guy that was trying to get her to admit something that she didn't do and just choking her when he couldn't get what he wanted. All of that was just like really hard to watch. But then like the switch when Dr. Harrison came out and meeting Dr. Harrison and the situation and how she came out and how she was able to flip it around on the therapist so quickly. I really enjoyed seeing her. I liked the return of Mr. Nobody. And I like that he mentioned, like, I haven't been in two episodes. This cannot be the end. So like the whole like fourth wall breaking stuff. And the fact that he and Niles had to work together and to stop the apocalypse, and that allowed us to bring Niles back into the narrative with the Doom Patrol without that being like the end of the, like, there's, you know, they've been looking for Niles and now Niles is back, so how do we get Niles to not be back again so the Doom Patrol can still go looking for Niles? And they found a way to do that really worked. I liked the whole, like you guys are saying about, you know, Dr. Harrison, how she had to be the messiah for this group. And I like that her cult were all like mental patients because they're all like people that, you know, society has like forgotten in one way or the other. And she's not like, Dr. Harrison is not like going out. She's like, get out of the psych ward to talk to mainstream society. She's talking to these people in the psych ward, and you know, they're as ridiculous as like the idea sound of like, well, why does this, is very sexist, why does it have to be a man, why can't it be a dog, why can't it be an invisible ink, like all these like ideas that are, you know, really like out there, and like using that and coming up with this like elaborate plan. It's very Doom Patrolling in a way that it shouldn't work, but it actually does all work together in the end, and the way that it all comes together with how she said, you know, like, what do we do? Like, dance, just dance. and how that comes into the present with all of these like geriatric cult members
dancing.
Ring the bell, like, you know, Chaka Khan is like all really works in a very like wacky and elaborate way. And I love also like Rita continuing, you can kind of get more of her mothering side, like in the comics, like Rita is Gar's adopted mom. And so this kind of feels like pre-Gar, like Rita and Elliot, like I could see like her like relationship would be with Gar. Although we don't know whether Gar is past or present in this timeline where we are, if he's met the Doom Patrol yet or not. And it was really sad watching her, like, you know, tell Elliot, you know, you have do all the things that you want to do with your life, and then kind of gets decreated right beside her. That was really sad. Mm-hmm. The ending scene, well, like the recreator was also like another eye in the sky. Yeah. Like, it wasn't like a thing. It was just like another eye. And then they like had like a staring contest with each other. I thought it was really funny. The ending scene with Niles having to go back and return to Mr. Nobody. And I think the fact that, you know, when he's trying and Mr. Nobody like cut in and Niles was like, you told me I had more time. Like, you really felt like up until that point, it just seemed like Niles was very like la-di-da about, yeah, I disappeared. So what? Whatever. I don't really care about that. I'll have to go back. But like in that moment, like he did actually care. Like you could, you know, he has been putting on this like brave front for most of the episode, but he does actually care a lot about each of these people. And you can see that in the moments, little small moments that he got with most of them throughout the episode. Yes. Dislikes. Let's go.
I forgot to mention in my likes that I did love that. What's his face? Mr. Nobody was back because he's like, but I haven't even been in the last two episodes.
And yeah.
That was really funny. Sorry, go ahead, Tati.
Right, well, like even after he saw Jane as a child, Jane as a child, he was like, oh, if we're going to die, I want to spend my last minutes with Jane. And I was like, oh. Yeah. But in general, that's what I was going to say. Okay, that's what it was. My biggest dislike in general was just Cliff's, like, I don't even know if to call it an arc anymore, because it's like he seems like every episode, he's like, well, I'm going to be an asshole to these people. And then I'm going to learn that I don't need to be an asshole. And I was like, well, we've already learned this, Cliff, haven't we? So, like, him being an asshole to, like, Jane's other personalities because they're not Jane was just, like he had to learn that. Exactly.
All Janes are Janes.
Exactly. I was going to say, I obviously haven't learned this lesson either, because I'm like, Oliver Twist is a person too, okay? But I don't know Oliver Twist's name. But yes, they're a person, and they were a nice personality. Why would you scare them off and bring back Hammerhead, stupid? So yeah, that was really annoying to me. I didn't find it, I don't know, humorous or whatever. I do appreciate still, like, the depth of the bond that Jane and Robot Man have, but I don't like you said, that Matt Bomer may be correct. It's going to get sexy, and I don't want it to get sexy. I still like Victor being like, oh no, we can't work with this evil person. When, like, the apocalypse was at stake, I was like, is this really the time to bring up the, like, oh no, not Mr. Nobody. I thought that was a little bit, like, unnecessary. Like, I like where it led. Like, I like the scene he had with Niles, but I thought it was, like, a little bit, like, again, like, setting up, like, a false dichotomy, I guess, just to be like, Victor is like this. So I didn't think it was necessary. Also, something, I guess I just, like, Niles talked about how there is a limit to Mr. Nobody's omnipotence. But, like, what is that limit? Like, you can't stop the end of the world, but Jane's other personality can with the power of influence, right? But he can stop the dude from stabbing his eye out by, like, freezing time. So, like, that's pretty powerful. And also, he could just, like, go through time and pick out the Jane that he wants to redirect her life. So, I just have questions about his omnipotence, and I would like a little, like, kind of like Jane's personalities. I would like a little chart that explains to me what he can do, why he can do it, and what he cannot do. Because right now it's just like, it doesn't seem like there's a rhyme or reason to his powers. I think this is probably the first episode where we really got a handle of what those powers are, but I'm not sure what they do other than what the plot wants them to do. I feel like those are my dislikes. I can't think of anything else at the moment. There was something else I was going to say relating to that, sort of just like, oh, I mean, I guess it's just in general, like you pointed out when we were watching, Jane was an adult in 1977. So once again, we still have the situation where like all these people are immortal. They're not aging for decades, but like no one's even brought it up, I don't think, unless I just like blacked out. No one's like, wait a second, why are we all immortal? Like everyone's cool with this. And I think that at some point that should be brought up, because I'm sure Victor isn't, for example, because Victor has not been part
of
this.
Victor is like the baby of that group.
Yeah, Victor's the baby. And
he's like the leader.
He's like the grandson.
Exactly.
He's like the grandson.
Yeah. So I think it would be, and maybe this is a prediction, I don't know, but I think it would be great for him to sort of point that out. Like if there was like old pictures or they're talking about some shit that happened in the 60s and he's like, wait a second. Cause right now I'm just like, am I crazy or are y'all crazy? Like, why is no one aging? So yes, there we go.
Me?
Yeah. I definitely agree about Cliff because he hasn't progressed, right? Like Tati said, he just continues. I don't even think he learns in every episode that he's just being an asshole. He just is, and he continues to do it. And I don't think ever since that they stopped like showing us flashbacks to his old life and his daughter and stuff like that, I think everything has come to a pause with him. Everything for him revolves around Jane, which is somewhat creepy. If we're thinking about it in a romantic sense.
It is. It's very creepy.
Yeah. So I'd like for him to have some like more forward movement. And I agree about Victor too. I think, like I said, like his talk with the chief was nice, but considering he works with the Doom Patrol who are the gray area, it's just bizarre that he decides to think that because he's a hero, he can't stand in that area at all. Especially like he was working with Willoughby for however long. So like for Chief to work with Mr. Nobody to prevent something even bigger from happening makes sense. But like he doesn't get it because his mind is kind of like.
I feel like direction. The Doom Patrol aren't even an area. Like they're not even. They refuse to be any kind of hero.
They're like chaotic neutral. They're just like, whatever.
Yeah, they're just there. But he's trying to make them good, so he still doesn't see them as good, you know what I mean? I think those were like my major dislikes, though. Other than that, I think it was a really solid episode.
I'm surprised neither of y'all have said my major dislike.
I maybe just don't remember it because I didn't write anything down.
It has to do with Cliff because it has to do with Cliff, maybe like you like blanked out at that point, but. Overall, okay, I do agree with you. Like, he's probably like my least favorite in the sense that he's just very yelly and there's not really anything else going on with him. Like, I already mentioned, like, the whole like weird thing with Jane, but the biggest thing that I didn't like was that at the end, when Nobody freezes time, Cyborg's cannon, and Cyborg accidentally like blows up and his arm blows off and he's in pain, but he's like, and they're like, what do you want us to do? And he's like, don't worry, I'll figure it out. Don't do the SOS. And then Cliff still
did it anyway.
It on him.
Yes. I did not like that.
Yeah.
At all.
I forgot because then nothing happened. I thought that the episode was going to end there. We had to like find out what happens with the dad or whatever. And then the next thing it was just like, weird montage, and well, that didn't go anywhere.
Yeah,
so I was like,
think
oh.
Something is still going to happen because, you know, we had that in that montage, you had the scene of Silas trying to call and him declining the call, but I don't think that that's the end of it. Like, something is definitely going to happen with the fact that Cliff pushed the button. And I don't like that he did that.
Yeah. He's definitely ignoring what Cyborg wanted for himself, so.
Definitely ignoring what Cyborg wanted for himself. He ignores every Jane that is not Jane. Yeah, he's my least favorite at the moment. Like Larry started to build some credibility back with me. Mm-hmm. But Cliff has yet to do that.
Yeah, I really liked the scene. I forgot to say, I did like the scene with Larry and Cliff where he says, realizes that he's the one that's like torturing himself or whatever. And then he feels like he tortures
him. Yeah, on the bus.
Okay.
Yeah. Do we have any like specific predictions?
No.
You just had one.
Yeah.
Something's going to happen.
Something's going to happen. I feel like that's maybe that'll be like the thing that like really ramps up the whole Silas has been lying to you your whole metahuman life. Or because like on Titans, like Young Justice, not Titans, but Young Justice, the father box makes Cyborg like act all like crazy or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if like the SOS button is like father box technology or whatever.
Oh,
that's a good one.
And he kind of goes like off the rails, like he can't control it. So
that maybe would be interesting.
Happen. Yeah. Side B, Lady with Gumption nominations. Who do we have?
Oh, okay.
I'm going to say Grace Kata for sure.
Yeah.
Grace Kata. Dr. Harrison for sure.
Marilyn.
Marilyn, yep, that's another one. I was going to say Marilyn too. From Arrow, wait, that's Saye. Oops, nope. We already said Dinah.
Black Lightning. What's
Black Lightning? Was anyone really gumptioning?
I would say Lynn.
Jace. You know what? Dr. Jace had the gumption to think.
She did.
She isn't important enough.
Yeah. I've cut her into bias.
I mean, Jennifer had like
that is like gumption. White woman gumption right there.
Yes, white woman gumption.
Set aside black woman and promote me to be your number two.
So of those, who would we like to go up against? Dinah.
Oh crap. Well, not Jace.
Right. We can eliminate Jace.
Yeah.
And if Lynn was in the running, we can eliminate her.
Yeah.
I would say
Grace.
Grace?
Grace Kata.
Yeah.
Grace Kata? Okay. All right. So.
But I really like Marilyn for being like in a loony bin and like Dr. Harrison giving her purpose and then her coming and actually like being like, you know, fuck all of this and I'm going to blow you up with my tank. And like she came in with that tank for like a purpose, you know, to be the sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we can do three. Let's say Dinah versus Grace Kata versus Marilyn.
Marilyn.
Mm-hmm.
It's Grace Kata and Marilyn for me.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sorry, Dinah.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Okay. Well, if it's between Grace Kata and Marilyn, I would say my only reason to not do Grace is because we haven't gotten enough of, like, her. Like, it was like she came in and she was like, I'm going to fuck y'all up. And that was great. But I don't have any motivations. I don't have any.
True.
Like, what happened between her 2019 coma and her 2049? She could be from a different year. I don't know what year she's from, actually. She doesn't look like she's 2049. Is that even the year? What year is it?
Yeah, I assume it's 2049 where she's from.
Okay. But anyway. But whereas Marilyn, I think that it was like, it told her whole story in one episode without even, you know, we didn't even get that much of her, but like you got a real sense of who she was and what, like you said, the purpose that she was given in
what Harrison's belief, like the whole episode was about belief and like, you know, creating a religion and getting people, even you, getting people to believe in Dr. Harrison. But it was Harrison's belief in Marilyn that allowed Marilyn to come back and be like really pivotal in stopping the apocalypse in the future.
Exactly. All right. What do you think, May?
I can't argue with Marilyn, right?
Marilyn is. Yes.
Great.
That
success.
Is our very, very long episode. We had a lot of like really deep discussions about frustrating things that happen in the Arrowverse. So if you enjoyed those, then you can join us again next week when we do it all over again.
Oh my god.
All right. Talk to you guys later.
Bye.
Bye.